Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Museum of Science, where you can experience the heart of New England, their new giant screen film showcasing this iconic region. You can see it now on the IMAX Dome screen. Tickets at mos.org.
I'm Jim Brady, head on Boston Public Radio. NBC political director Chuck Todd joins us for his weekly political roundup, including his one-on-one with New Hampshire's Governor Chris Sununu about the lies of Fox News. And the city council in Boston has approved Mayor Wu's rent control proposal. With rental prices through the roof in Boston and inflation freezing housing sales, we'll open lines to hear from you. Is rent control part of the solution?
I'm Marjorie Egan. Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung will detail what comes next on Mayor Wu's rent control proposal and inquiries from auditor Diana DiZoglio into the state legislature and alleged racism at the Massachusetts Convention Center Authority. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Howdy, I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. Where are we tomorrow again?
We are at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. We're very excited about it.
We are. So we're joined now by Chuck Todd. Chuck's the political director for NBC News, as well as the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. That's Channel 10 on most providers here. He also co-hosts Meet the Press Now on NBC Now and hosts the Chuck Toddcast with new episodes every Wednesday. Hello there, Chuck Todd.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to hear you guys together.
I know it's a rare occurrence.
I haven't gotten the double team from you guys here in a while, so I look forward to it.
Well, Jim has been sloughing off. Is the sad state of affairs? But
I've been on assignment. Actually, is what
that's
I
right.
We call
he's
it.
He's been on assignment. That's what Bill O'Reilly always used to say.
What's that?
Remember?
Right. What island?
Which Caribbean island? Yeah, which Caribbean island are you on assignment?
Yeah.
Wait for the report.
No one was on vacation.
By the way, I'm not kidding. I do have somebody who may come on my show this week who is wondering, do you have to tell them where I'm going to be coming from if you interview me?
Oh, you mean,
some elected officials don't like people to know where they vacation.
Especially if it's like Turks and Caicos or something like that. Is that what you're talking about?
Who knows, right? Yeah, no, it's not there. Because we don't have those resources.
Okay. So, I have to admit, I've been on an anti-Fox News crusade for quite some time. Having been sued and having made mistakes as a journalist, it drives me crazy what they've been able to get away with over there. But now, as this Dominion lawsuit proceeds, we're finding out more and more wacky things. For example, that Tucker Carlson, who is now misrepresenting what was on in January 6th, apparently he said for President Trump that he hated him passionately, and Rupert Murdoch hated him passionately. Those were his words. I hate him passionately. And Rupert Murdoch, who is the chief guy, who's 89 years old, but apparently quite with it, talked about how President Trump, was concerned that President Trump, after the 2020 election, was growing, quote unquote, increasingly mad, as in crazy. So where does this put Fox, and how do people that are in the sway of Fox get out of the sway of this station? Maybe that's not your job,
so,
but I do wonder about it.
You're not wrong, and I wonder about that. You know, are there going to be viewer consequences, right? Like,
yeah.
Look, when we had a prominent anchor lie, okay, get caught lying, we, of course, at NBC News, removed that anchor, period.
Yes.
Right? That person was no longer allowed on NBC News. I don't want to get into it, but we did it. I mean,
we know who it is. He was a big star. I believe you're talking about Brian Williams.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was not an easy decision.
No.
To do to an individual, but it was an easy decision to protect the integrity of NBC News. And so, I look at it. Look, we were going to get punished by viewers, and our credibility would be punished. The problem with Fox is they don't have credibility with anybody other than their own people. So the question really is, oh my God, Fox is losing credibility. Marjorie's not paying, they already didn't have credibility with you, right?
Right.
Before this Dominion lawsuit. They already didn't have credibility with me, and with many other sort of people. But the question I wonder is, for the people that they still had credibility with, are they going to know that Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity didn't really believe in what, didn't really, you know, sort of treated them as sort of functionaries to get them rich, that they just basically, you know, used them and lied to them regularly because they just told them what they wanted to hear so that they would keep coming. You know, they were nothing more than an advertising dollar in their mind. Are those voters going to know that's what happened? Are they going to consume the Dominion lawsuit that way? And will it, in long term, turn people away from those folks? I don't know. You know, people tune into Fox now, not because they want the truth, because they don't want the truth. They want to be told what they want to hear. So I don't know if there's punishment for here. The question is whether elected Republicans, you know, does going on Fox alienate the middle of the electorate, right? And that could be, right? Does all things Tucker Carlson alienate the middle of the electorate? And that could be the case. And it may be, so it really, I do think it puts Republican elected officials who would like to believe they're not drinking the Trump Kool-Aid in a tough spot because they still got to talk to the Kool-Aid drinkers in their mind. But can you go on Fox and do that? I don't know. But I, you know, you're asking me whether the Fox viewer will consume everything we're consuming. I think a lot of it will depend on whether there's an actual trial. Because if there's an actual trial, it'll be hard for Fox viewers not to know what's going on.
Yeah, well, I would say that even if they did learn what's going on, just like they learned all the warts on Donald Trump, they may not care. Because, as you say, they want to be preached to. And if the preacher is imperfect, even if a liar, they can handle it. And speaking of lying, by the way, and how people are going to handle this, Chris Sununu, who I do not consider to be one of the lunatics in the Republican Party, is on with you and uses the same fourth grade line that we get in our comments during the show. They all lie. They all lie. I mean, how pathetic was that, Chuck Todd?
I know. It was. And then, you know, a little bit of pushback, and I think he realized toward the end that it was sort of a silly thing to have done, and he tried to sort of backtrack a tad. But, you know, that's my point here. You're like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, you want to sit here and do that? Let's do apples to apples. When a prominent person got caught lying on our air, they were taken off the air. Period.
And by the way, Chuck,
NBC News ever again. That's what a news organization does.
I was just going to say, Brian Williams was the anchor of the nightly news. He was like in that triumvirate at a time when this was a huge, big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, less so now because fewer people watch the evening news at 6 o'clock. But then it was a huge loss. And frankly, he was a very talented guy. I used to watch him at 11 o'clock on MSNBC, and I miss him.
He is a talented guy.
Very talented guy.
It's a bummer. It's a bummer that, you know, he got to place where he ended up going down that road. It can happen to a lot of good people. Very talented broadcaster, and it's a real, I think he did a great job at sort of at communicating to people what they needed to know. And it's a bummer, but credibility matters. And it was going to, but you know, ironically, we made a business decision too. We didn't, you know, we did it as a journalistic organization, but we also believed that it was going to hurt our bottom line if we kept somebody who knowingly misled their audience on the air to deliver the news, right? So we made both a journalistic decision, but we also knew our audience actually judged us on whether we were liars or not. The problem we have here is the market that Fox, you know, Fox is competing with Alex Jones. They're not competing with real journalists.
Right.
So, you know, Tucker Carlson is basically just Alex Jones on Fox. There's no difference anymore.
Well, it's also analogous to Trump saying the other day, and I totally subscribe to this, sadly, that if he's indicted, his numbers are going to go up. I mean, it's more like...
Well, inside the GOP, they might.
Yeah, exactly.
Inside the GOP, they might. Yeah.
But, Chuck, one last thing about this. We get in our text messages, people conflate, for example, the Steele dossier that had Trump cavorting with prostitutes in Russia and turned out not to be true. Mm-hmm. People were reporting on that. It was a mistake. People corrected the mistake. But people, I think, that don't know the journalism business conflate intentional lies, like what they're doing at Fox, with a maybe we shouldn't have reported on it mistake, which people corrected.
With bad journalistic decisions.
That's
right. Look, BuzzFeed and CNN made terrible journalistic decisions in publishing the Steele dossier. I vehemently and publicly chastised Ben Smith, the editor-in-chief at the time of BuzzFeed, and any journalist who did it. Ben Smith, to his credit, came on my air to defend his decision in doing it. But we had a robust debate about it. And my whole thing was, you have not verified this. Why do this? You're only, and by the way, I do think it harmed everybody's credibility. Yep. And that was my, because I knew it was going to get used. Even though BuzzFeed did not have the reputation that other news organizations had, you know, it was developing one, and there were people there that journalists respected, like Ben Smith. And the minute they did that, it was a stain on everybody. And that's, you know, unfortunately, that is, we're on a, you know, look, it's a war over truth that we're in this country right now. And every journalist that does seek truth has to realize it is not just their own reputation that's on the line. It's all of our reputations that are on the line.
Well, you know,
I do think about that more often than I think. I think that, you know, I'd like to think I do. I hope I do. I hope other journalists do, too.
By the way, I want you to know it's your fault because alternative facts actually happened, as you well know, on Meet the Press, and it's been downhill from there ever since from Kellyanne Conway.
Hey, you know, that's the point. Calling it out, bringing attention to it, has only, like, galvanized some of these folks on the right.
You know? They're finally.
We want alternative facts. We don't want the truth. Give us something different. Like, they actually, it's crazy.
You know, just in case people don't know, Kellyanne and George are finally thrown in the towel. They're getting divorced.
Okay,
she's working for Fox. He's on other stations criticizing the right-wing lunacy all the time.
You know, Chuck Todd, I think a lot of people consider this whole D.C. crime bill killing as an inside story that no one cares about. I worry that it's indicative of how the Democrats are going to behave leading up to 2024. They don't want to be accused of being soft on crime, so they join with the Republicans. When every Republican, a la CPAC, is trashing the most vulnerable people in America, trans people, are Democrats going to take the same strategy on that too?
Well, I don't think on the transgender stuff, but I think on the border and crime, they are. And I think you saw it a little bit also on the border, right, where suddenly you have Biden more open to some of these.
The family detention stuff and the asylum denials, right.
And what I find interesting is how muted the criticism from the left has been.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that, and look, this is, you know, Biden, I think, bought progressives by fighting for the more progressive agenda the first 2 years. He got 70% of what he fought for. And I do think progressives, at least the smart ones, realize that, hey, we are kind of a political liability in some places. You know, we have been the single reason why the state of Florida is no longer in play, you know, because of the S word in South Florida. So, you know, I do think that the progressive movement is maturing in a good way here, where they sort of a pragmatic streak is coming to them. But I understand why you're asking on trans. I don't think so on trans. I really think the cruelty is what's going to be when you look at the intentional cruelty that these bills have, I think, you know, I just saw an interesting study of women voters, independent women voters and Republican women voters in Arizona and Pennsylvania. And it's more qualitative. It's very hard to share, but it was a big deck in it. But the bottom line is this, the Republican women, and independent women are not happy with the Democrats, but they're scared of the Republicans. Okay? They are scared of what the Republicans are doing. And they are voting against anything Trump touches. And they're voting on the abortion issue. The abortion issue was the single most important issue to independent women. And it was much more of a factor in the 2022 elections, I think, than exit polls captured. And I do think that in that score, this is where the trans stuff, because I do think mothers don't like this. This is their kids. You're being cruel to.
Hope you're right.
So I see where you're asking that. I do think that there is certainly some Democrats that don't like the woke stuff and don't want to be associated with all the different pronoun this and you know, there's that stuff. But I don't think on the cruelty to individual kids. No, I don't think Democrats are going to be that Machiavellian. I don't.
And, you know, speaking of abortion, the New York Times has done great reporting on this suit by these women in Texas, mothers, some of them with other children, who needed abortions for medical reasons. They, one of them almost was becoming septic and almost died. Another one had a fetus with no brain, all these that was causing infection in her body. I mean, these horrific tales. And yeah. There's going to be a lot of those, I think, between now and the election, considering the bans on abortion and physicians being afraid to go against them. And I can't help think, even though, you know, Jim often complains that women aren't out in the street protesting, or we aren't in general.
Men either, by the way.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I don't think people who are so-called pro-life or anti-abortion are keen on letting mothers die in states like Texas.
Look, I do think that you know, the DeSantis is going to, of all the bills this legislature is going to pass in the next 3 months, that sort of is all going to be viewed as sort of DeSantis preparing to run for president. It's that 6-week abortion ban that he's going to regret more than anything else. He's going to get defined by that. You know, DeSantis was the one governor being a little more cautious than some of the others in the South with 15 weeks. And at the, you know, 15 weeks looked a lot more moderate than what Georgia was doing, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, all of that. And now they're going to go 6. This is Florida. Florida has a lot of libertarians in it too, right? The same people that didn't like the mask mandate also don't like this. So I think this is, they're playing with a lot of fire near gas tanks and propane tanks when it comes to abortion bans.
Hey, you know, Chuck Todd, we only have a couple of minutes left, but Marjorie reminded me of a topic that she and I talk about almost all the time, which is how pathetically passive the American people are in the face of assaults from their government or the Supreme Court. You know, one day demonstration, and then we take to tweeting for the next few months. In France, there are millions of people in the street over raising the retirement age, just shutting down trains, flights. The dock workers are up in arms, and they're rolling strikes there. Why is it that so much of the rest of the Western world does what French people, workers, are doing now, and we do a one-day deal and then retreat to our little caves, no matter how egregious the hit on us is? What's that about?
Well, I mean, I might argue that we trust it. I know I'm about to say something that feels counter to everything we talk about over the last couple of years, but I do think that this is an odd comfort and trust in our own system. Mm. You know, when we see democracy, when we see protests multiple days in a row in another country, do you think that country is stable or unstable? Mm.
Yeah, good point.
Right? So, I mean, yeah. I think that there is a odd comfort in that we sort of trust our system that this stuff works itself out. And if you look at it from the long view, I mean, I always say I'm a long-term optimist and a short-term pessimist. You know, I think the next 10 years are going to suck. Okay, I think but do I think, you know, my goodness, look at the 1950s. I just went through some old transcripts of Joseph McCarthy on Meet the Press. The guy was a blatant anti-Semite on the air in the 1950s, and that was reelected in Wisconsin, not in Idaho. Okay, so I mean, he's like using the phrases "30 pieces of silver being sold." I mean, he's just. My point was, it's like as bad as everybody, as so many bad actors we have right now. I swear to God, it used to be worse. Okay? And it's like, so my point is, we eventually, you know, Churchill was right, you know, we exhaust every bad idea before we finally do the right thing. But we eventually do the right thing, and it's awfully close. I'm not going to sit here and say a couple of people may not fall off the cliff. But for the most part, we'll probably avoid going up.
Boy, I feel a hell of a lot
better. I do,
better.
Too.
Thank you, Chuck.
I'm bucked up. It could be worse. Right. I think that's the way to look at this.
Okay, hey, we're out of time.
Get your bumper sticker.
That's
America,
right.
America 2024. It could be worse.
Could be worse. I love that.
Chuck, thanks a lot.
See you, Chuck. Talk to you next week.
All right, my guys.
Chuck Todd is political director of NBC News, NBC political director, I should say, moderator of Meet the Press, co-host of Meet the Press Now on NBC News, and host, I love this, of the Chuck Toddcast, new episodes every Wednesday. You can also catch Meet the Press Sunday mornings, 10:30, NBC, Boston, Channel 10 on most providers.
We only have 10 more years to go through.
Ten sucky years, that's what he said.
Beautiful.
Okay, after a quick break, the Boston City Council just voted to approve Mayor Wu's rent control proposal. We're going to open the lines to hear what you think about the idea. You think it's great? Or do you think this is going to make more condo conversion and more gentrification happen? The number is 877-301-8970. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. We're live at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. In a vote yesterday, 11 in favor, 2 opposed, the Boston City Council approved Mayor Michelle Wu's proposed cap on rent increases in the city to 10% or less, depending on inflation. This is just the first step for advocates of rent control or rent stabilization. There's a long way to go. A lot of powerful people have to sign on, like the legislative leaders in the legislature, as well as the governor. And, of course, on the other side, there'll be organizations like the Greater Boston Real Estate Board spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars working to ensure this doesn't pass. Meanwhile, rent prices are surging. The average cost of an apartment in the city was $365 more last year than the year before. That's a 14% increase, 4% more than would be legal under Wu's proposal. In a poll by an organization called Change Research, the issue came out this way. 68% of the people statewide said they strongly or somewhat supported Wu's proposal. 22%, that's a 3-to-1 margin, were in opposition. 10 said they didn't have an opinion. Somerville also hopes to move forward a home rule petition on this issue. Cambridge maybe too. We want to know where you are on this rent control proposal. We'll describe it a little better in a minute at 877-301-8970. And let me put another question on the table, Marjorie, if I can. Not only where are you on this rent control, are you as outraged as I am by the fact that Boston cannot decide with its own elected officials
or any other city or town
exactly what its rent policy will be, but rather it has to be approved by legislators from 351 cities and towns and a governor? It is insane. It's called a home rule petition. 877-301-8970. Can I spend 10 seconds just describing this proposal?
Yes, and I'm not sure the home rule petition works for anybody anywhere, does it? I mean, maybe
I don't know, but I know there's something. No, I don't know. I mean, I don't follow all the legislators.
Liquor licenses? What is just businesses of theirs?
That's not a home rule petition. They have to be actually approved at the legislative level, I think.
Why should the legislature vote on a liquor license in Boston?
They should absolutely. Exactly. By the way, let me just say this. If it turns out a policy being adopted by a place like Boston or Cambridge or, you know, Lexington, whatever, if the policy in the town or city will affect people beyond the borders of the town or city, then it should be a state legislative issue. When the decision is purely about what should rent levels be and should they be regulated in Boston, why is it anybody's right in the other 350 cities and towns to pass on? In fact, let me just say this before I describe this rent control thing. For those of you who don't know, rent control, the repeal of rent control was in the ballot, I think, in 1994.
Right.
Three cities had rent control then. I think it was Boston, Cambridge, and Brookline. Am I right about that? Okay. Those three cities that had rent control voted overwhelmingly to keep it. The 348 cities and towns that did not have rent control, which weren't affected, voted to get rid of it. And as a result, statewide, I think it was 51-49, this thing was repealed. And by the way, let me just say one other thing about this proposal.
Okay,
two other things.
You're wound up.
I am wound up. This Wu's proposal is not a mandate. It gives the right to any city or town through its legislative process to adopt a petition to impose rent stabilization in that community. It's not a mandate kind of thing. What she would do, by the way, is a 10% max, 4% above inflation, right? So if inflation was 2%, the increase would be 6%. If inflation was 9%, then it would be capped at 10. It's more moderate than other rent control proposals around the country, including in places like California. Number two, to deal with developers and those who say it's going to harm new development, she brilliantly, I think, exempted new development from rent control for the first 15 years. So it shouldn't be a problem there. Exempts small buildings. I think it's 3 family units. Maybe it's even more, but 3 family units. She crafted it very moderately. And I think to the credit of the city council here, some of whom wanted a more dramatic proposal, they decided this was probably the best one that had a chance to make it through the legislature. So we want to know where you are on this thing, rent control, rent stabilization. And how do you feel about the procedural thing that the legislature has got to pass on something that has an effect on nobody except those people who live in Boston? I'm done.
I think one of the big problems she's going to have with this is there's no means test. And the
you asked her about that last time. We listened this morning. She actually didn't answer the question directly as to why there's no means testing.
Yeah, there used to be in the old rent control, even though
no, there didn't. No, there didn't. And well, the one that was repealed? And no, no.
Okay,
I don't
then
think
there
so.
Wasn't. You're, I'm sorry, you're right. There was not, but that was a proposal that people on the other side made.
Yeah.
There should be, because what was happening is a lot of wealthy people were in rent control apartments, and they were meant for people that were not wealthy, and it was abused in that sense.
But that was the biggest part of the anti campaign in Cambridge. By the way, the head of GBH at that time was in a rent controlled apartment.
A Superior Court judge was in a rent controlled apartment. A city councilor in Cambridge was for mayor for Cambridge for a while. He was in a rent controlled apartment. There were lots of people that were in rent controlled apartments. And that's one of the fears this time that it could happen again. But, you know, the situation wasn't nearly as dire in the 90s as it
is
now.
That's a wonderful point.
I mean, what did one of these stories say that rent went up in? Climbed 14%.
I just said that 14% last year. 14%
in 1 year. Mm-hmm. I would argue that the landlord's getting a little greedy here. You know, I mean, there are downsides to rent control. If you lived in a city with rent control, you notice that the rent control apartments looked a mess. They were not kept up by their landlords.
Some.
That was their excuse. They couldn't afford to fix the places up. But it did enable in Brookline, where I live.
No, excuse me. I was a lawyer who dealt with rent control in the South Bronx. To say they couldn't afford to keep it up is not true.
Well, that's what they would
say. In many cases, they chose not to keep it up.
That's what they would say. Yeah. And a lot of these apartments were right near where I live on Beacon Street, and they were in disrepair. On the other hand, it enabled a whole lot of people that were low income to live in Brookline,
sure,
to go to the Brookline schools. And once rent control was gone, they were gone. It also brings in a lot of condo conversion because landlords will say, well, hey, okay, I don't want to be told how much to rent, so I'm going to forget the rent. I'm going to go and convert my apartment to condo.
10% is not enough for these landlords. 10%, a double-digit increase.
Listen, I think we're in an emergency. Not only is rent control the rent increase is a huge problem, but on the front page of the Globe today is a story about how with the interest rates so high, people that might want to sell their homes, particularly people that are retirees and want to downsize, they don't want to do it because they don't want to have to get a mortgage someplace else at 6% or 7% or whatever it's going to be, you know, if the Fed ever decides to stop raising interest rates. So we're just squeezed. And I think that's what's pushing a lot of this, too. It's gotten out of hand, Jim.
So where are you on this rent stabilization proposal by the mayor of Boston? And just to make me happy, feel free to trash the legislative process if you so choose. Let's start in Lexington with David. David, what's up?
Hi. I'm both a renter and a landlord, and I'm totally with you, Jim, that renters are struggling and we need to do something. But this proposal, and my rental property is not in Boston, so I don't have an immediate interest here, but, you know, if it's going to be a statewide thing allowed.
No, it would not be. By the way, it's not a proposal
Boston.
For a statewide. It would allow individual cities and towns to decide
to
impose it
if
they chose. Okay.
I didn't say that well.
Okay, I'm sorry.
But the rent board, proposal that Mayor Wu has put forth here, although it seems on the face of it reasonable that landlords could raise the rent inflation plus 6% each year, I think it's 6%.
4%.
Yeah, 4%.
4%.
Yeah.
4%. Okay. There's a provision in there, if you read that whole proposal carefully, where it is actually the rent control board that has the final say. So they can override that inflation plus 4% thing anytime they want to. And small landlords, I'm a small landlord, I struggle to keep my tenants' rent low.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean low.
I got it.
Yeah. And to, you know, if I have a big expense, it's you know, I mean, I start thinking about maybe I should just sell my rental property if it came to my town because it's a difficult.
Well, you know,
David, how small a landlord are you?
I have one rental property in Massachusetts.
Then
and
you,
one.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not sure, but if you are, well, you're not in the, and you don't live in the same building. I was going to say if you're
that's
in a building.
That's right. I don't live in the same building.
By the way, David, the other thing you mentioned, I have read, I would say, every article that's been written. I have not read the actual proposed legislation. I've never read that a rent control board can override the 10%, but we will check it. And
I
hear what you say, but I want to read it myself. David, thank you for your call. We appreciate your perspective. 877-301-8970.
I know under the old rules in Brookline, you did have to go into the rent control board if you wanted to do something and get something different. And I once went in there once. I felt like I was the Tsarina going into the den of the Bolsheviks, Jim.
Why were you there?
Because I had bought my first little piece of property in Brookline, my husband and I, and he got a fellowship and we wanted to go away for the year and rent the apartment.
Mm-hmm. They wouldn't let you do it?
Well, we were grandfathered in, but the mortgage was like, you know, those days it was cheap, $1,500 a month or something, but they told us we could only rent it for $500 because it was under rent control. And I thought, wow, we're not going to be able to go now because we won't be able to afford it. But we were grandfathered in. But the treatment of people that were condo owners, like I said, you know, it was lucky I wasn't, you know, like Nicholas and Alexandra, you know what I mean? They didn't like me very much there at the rent control board.
This is a very moderate proposal compared to other rent control laws around the country. Is it California that I was reading this morning that the maximum increase is even lower than inflation? I'm not advancing that as a proposal, but anybody who thinks this is a radical proposal is just, you know, buying into the rhetoric rather than reading the data. And, you know, in all fairness, how can developers, how can people in the real estate industry say it's going to cut development off at the knees when there's a 15-year exemption?
You know what the city of Boston could do? That you hear this from developers and construction people all the time. The number of regulations and the hassles you have to go through for building anything in Boston. Even Michelle Wu talked about this when she was in Chicago.
What's
that
with rent control?
Make it less onerous and expensive for developers to build.
Right, it has nothing to do with this proposal.
I think
it's an independent notion that, regardless of whether it's rent stabilization or not,
it has to do with sweetening the pot for
developers. Oh, I see
what
you're saying. Okay.
That's what it has to do.
Let's go to Mike and Everett. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Hey, Jim and Marjorie, good afternoon.
You too.
I fully support Mayor Wu's initiative. First of all, we should credit her because she ran on this promise and she has delivered that she would put something
forward. It's a very good point, Mike.
As a former city councilor in Everett, I wish I only had the opportunity to present this for the city of Everett because out of the thousands of people I talk to on a regular basis in the city, most of them tell me about how they're struggling to make ends meet on a weekly basis. It's very appropriate because of the 15-year exemption. I don't believe it will stop development in a community, especially like Everett. We have hundreds of units being built currently in our city, and we don't want to stop that progress because housing is so desperately needed in the cities and towns of our state. But we need to do something to slow down increase of rents.
Mike, if the legislature approved this thing, what's your what odds would you give for DeMaria, the mayor, and the city council over there adopting rent stabilization for Everett?
You know what? I will be on the front lines trying to advocate as a member of the school committee currently. Yeah. I would advocate that families in Everett need this to stay in the communities, in the community,
yeah.
And hopefully potentially as a future candidate for city council, I would be on the front line to advocate that this is needed for our city and for the state.
Mike, did you vote to dump the superintendent or to keep the superintendent?
I'm talking about rent control today, Jim.
So obviously you voted to dump her. Mike, do me a favor. Stay on hold. We're going to want to talk to you because we're going to stay on that story. It's Mike. I'm going to say, you said you're a city. Mike McLaughlin, who we've spoken to a lot through the years, former city councilor, now in the school committee. Mike, stay on hold so we can get your number and we'll get back to you in the next couple of days. Thank you for the call.
Here's a text from a landlord. This is completely unfair to small landlords. Since when does the government tell any individual what they can charge for a product of theirs? I understand there's a housing crisis. That's why we pay taxes. When is it equitable to put a public burden on a private citizen? Don't say small landlords are exempt. It's only if they live in the building where the apartments are. Also, Jim, keep talking about it. Well, the rest of it, I don't understand what he means. But anyway, that's the point from a small landlord.
Okay, Mitch and Wellfleet, you're next. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I got 3 points. First, you know, you've got a problem with the entire structure of state government if you're, going on a rant about home rule petitions.
I agree. I do have a real problem with it. Yeah, I do.
Yeah, we both do, Mitch.
My point is just that it's got nothing to do with rent control. So, you know, you want to challenge the entire state government, that's fine, but that's a different issue.
It's not a different issue. It would apply to many things beyond rent control, but at this moment applies to this petition coming from the
state.
Right.
The legislature would have to vote on it.
But you'd have to restructure the entire state government. Okay, so that's a different project, is what I'm saying.
I agree.
You want to do that? Great.
Yeah.
Okay. My second point is that Mayor Wu has repeatedly emphasized that the vast majority of landlords do not raise their rent anywhere near the cap every year, and that the vast majority of landlords are good landlords. So, given that. Why is this necessary at all? What is it?
Well, first of all, it's necessary because you're wrong, Mike, with all due respect. The average rent increase, let me respond. The average rent increase last year was 4 points higher than the cap that would be in this law. It was 14%. So, in fact, Boston.
That's huge.
Yeah, it's huge. But go ahead, third point.
Said it's not. Has said that's not an issue. And you may have noticed.
What did you say, Mitch? I missed the beginning.
Mayor didn't like the facts. So he said it's not an issue. Good. Mayor Wu.
No. I'm just repeating what Mayor Wu said.
She never said that. We've spoken to her a dozen times.
She said it yesterday. She said
the average increase was 14%. That's more than 10. What's the third?
She said the vast. She said that. Okay.
Okay. Third point. Third point. Third point.
The third point is that everybody's focusing on this supposed reasonableness of this 10% cap, okay?
Yes.
But nobody's talking about the fact that there is a provision in there to set up rent control boards to issue regulations and that will allow rent increases according to what they determine.
That's what the first caller said.
Return.
We hear you. Okay, Two of you have said that. I don't know that to be true. Our staff are collecting are researching that. And Mitch, we thank you very much for the call. Can I speak to Mitch's thing? And he's right. The first thing he was right about, it's a larger issue, this home rule petition thing. My position is not that you have to change the structure of government. My position is that every legislator on Beacon Hill should say, if this is not happening in my community and community X, Lexington, Wellfleet, or Boston wants Y, I'm voting for it. If their local governing body and their chief official, a mayor, I'm automatically voting the way they voted.
Here's what I would like to restructure.
What?
I would like to know how my legislators vote. I don't think that's too much
to
ask.
It's a great point.
Is it that they can't hide behind these voice votes and refuse to tell you how they voted, which is really kind of a scam, and that's where
we're
at
now. Well,
it's
not only voice votes. It's voice votes. Votes in committee are not even going to be disclosed to us.
Votes in committee. You just don't know what they're doing up there, and I don't think it's a good thing. Anyway, we're going to keep talking about this for a few more minutes. The Boston City Council has approved Mayor Wu's plan, moving it to Beacon Hill on rent control. And that, of course, is where good and great ideas go to die. 877-301-8970 is our number, 877-301-8970.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're talking about the vote by the city council in Boston yesterday, 11-2, I think it was, 11-2, to embrace the rent stabilization proposal advanced by the mayor. Mayor Wu, we've talked to her a lot about it. She campaigned on it, as a caller said a couple of minutes ago. The one thing we are checking at the moment, two callers have said the exact same thing, which I believe to be untrue, but I'm not sure. So we're checking that the 10% cap on rent increases, 4% plus inflation to a max, could be lowered by whatever board is established by this legislation. I doubt that, but we are checking, and we'll try to let you know either before 12 or as soon as we find out the answer.
Here's Susan from Cohasset. The real issue that needs to be resolved is that there is a supply shortage of affordable housing. More housing must be built, otherwise rent control is just a Band-Aid that people will cheat on. And she's right, but the problem is, you know, we're not building enough affordable housing.
But to be fair to Mayor Wu, and I'm glad that person wrote, Mayor Wu, whenever she's asked about rent control, she says exactly what that woman says. It is only one piece of a solution, and you should embrace every part of a solution you can, that the supply does need to be increased. That's a huge issue with her, and I think most rent control supporters. Connie and JP, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you.
Hi. I thought having once run the rent control board for the city of Boston.
You did?
For 11 years. Yes, I did.
Whoa, great.
From 1984 until the end of rent control. So I know a lot about rent control, and I hope I can be helpful.
Please.
To you and your listeners.
Please.
But the one thing that really got me to the phone this morning was to say Boston actually had a means-tested system from certainly the time I was there in 1984 on, because with vacancy decontrol, the rent increase kicked in only if you were low to moderate income by the HUD standards. Elderly, I believe it was 65 at that time, could have been 62, or disabled, or, you know, any combination of those. So protections for all the, which was, by the way, 75% of all units that were under regulation were, in fact, in this decontrol standard. So it didn't really, so there was means testing there.
But by the way, Connie, if I can be clear, when I was speaking, just so that I was talking about Cambridge, which is all I knew because I lived there at the time of the vote. Cambridge was not means tested, but go ahead.
True.
Okay.
Yeah, and nor, I believe, was Brookline. I knew both of those. I knew all the directors over the years because I was at it for a long time. But Boston's was, and the law that's being proposed right now is specifically for Boston. And but here's what we learned with that. It was good that low, moderate income folks, elderly, disabled were protected. They then became the targets. And so there were a number of legal cases that we brought because people then had a harder time sometimes renting. So I leave it to everybody to evaluate both the pros and cons on means testing. But sometimes you've now created a class of tenants that people are now avoiding renting to, and they, of course, need the units, even when they have the money to rent at that moment. It's really about the increase. By the way, with vacancy decontrol, you entered at a market rate. The rent was not controlled going into the rental.
By the way, can we just say, for those who don't know the term, it means exactly what it says. When you vacate a rent-controlled apartment, it becomes decontrolled, thus the term.
Let me ask you a question, because I'm not an expert on this, and you are. But my concern, you raise a great point about people not wanting to rent to lower-income people. But in Brookline, where I do live and did live then with rent control, there was a whole stretch of Beacon Street that was rent control, and it was a lot of people that needed rent control. But there were a lot of other people that were really loaded. And that's a problem, right? I mean, what do you do about that?
Well, I think the thing is that so the type of rent control that Brookline had was regulating the rents and not regulating the units and the buildings, not the human beings.
Right.
The minute you go to the decontrolled system, which is what's basically being proposed here, it's all, everybody's coming in at a market rate.
Yep.
But remember, the rent control that you experienced, it didn't matter who rented the unit. The rent was set by the town.
Right.
So it's a very different regulatory scheme when you're regulating people versus you're regulating property.
Hey, Connie, we're really glad you called, and thank you for adding what you did to the
conversation. Well, before you leave, Connie, what do you think we should be doing?
You know, I think that Mayor Wu really started out with a good, understandable plan here that is reasonable and you know, should give, you know, especially as you have both mentioned, she's talking about a 15-year moratorium on rents.
Yeah.
It's going to happen 15 years. By the way, that was also true in Boston. Nothing prior that was built prior to 1968 was regulated in the Boston system ever. So we also had that what was called new construction. And once there's a board in place and regulations happen, my guess is that there'll be exemptions even further than the, you know, I don't know, of the owner-occupied threes, et cetera. So there's always, in a rent control, you always have to have a sort of, not an escape hatch, but you have to have something that releases the unanticipated situation that is unfair to the property owner.
Correct.
Otherwise, the law cannot stand.
Connie,
and
thanks.
That is an important.
We're thrilled that you called in. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Running the rent control board, too. We really
appreciate
it. Well,
that's where people get nervous about these rent control boards because, like I said, that's when the rent control was there before. That's where I had to go to plead for my exemption. And I was, like, as I said, the Tsarina in the den of the Bolsheviks.
Yeah, but the devil's in the details. I mean, again, we're still checking on this, friends. But if the callers are right and the rent board has the ability to lower the threshold below 10%, that's a concern. And the legislature could fix that, by the way. But we don't know it to be true. It also may be just a talking point that's sent out by the opponents. We're going to try to find out before we are done here. Alan and Waylon, what's up?
Hi there.
Hey.
So I always hear about one side of the ledger, which is the rent control, which is we're putting it on the shoulders of the owners of the properties to control the rent. But I think that all the taxpayers should contribute. And how you do that is that you go to the landlords and say, we're going to give you a tax break along with this rent control. So we all contribute to it. And the reason is, if we make it too hard for the landlords, we may not have landlords. They may get out of it.
Right.
Sell their properties. Right. And then if you have less properties, that makes it harder for everybody to get it, and rents will go up anyway. You have to consider both sides of the ledger. I never hear that discussion.
Well, you know, can I say, Alan, my recollection, and I could be wrong, is that a couple of the moderates on the Boston City Council who voted in favor of this proposal yesterday actually were discussing exactly what you were talking about earlier on. And I am guessing that that's something the legislature, assuming they want to consider this on the merits, could attach if they chose. It's a fine point, and thanks for making it, Alan. We appreciate it.
You know, I'll never forget when I was working for Boston Magazine doing a story about a little street right where, you know, where the Copley Square Mall is.
Sure.
You know, the Colony Hotel. There's a little street in there that had a big building, old building, must have been, I don't know, 100 apartments in there, and they were all rental apartments. And people have lived there for 30 and 40 and 50 years. And I did some story about this woman. She was like 85, this perfect little woman with little pearls around her neck and a little rouge on her cheeks and stuff like that. And in the previous rent control mess back then, what happened is they all got thrown out, and the developer bought it, and the entire place became condos. And all those people lost their homes. It was just horrible. I mean, and that's what you're afraid of, too, that if you do squeeze landlords too hard, that they'll just say, screw it.
Yeah, but keep in mind, there were three communities that had rent control for a lot of years, and all of them, I assume, considered the pros and cons in 94 and overwhelmingly decided we want to retain it. So at least the vast majority of the citizenry, voting citizens in Cambridge, Brookline, and Boston in 1994, weighed the pros and cons and said, I'm voting to keep it in place.
But that's not a bad idea, I don't think, particularly for small landlords at the college.
So that everybody shares the burden.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I told you, I think I'm pretty sure a couple of the moderate members of the council supported that position. But it passed 11-2. And essentially, the progressives who wanted a more radical, I don't mean that in a pejorative way, rent control proposal, decided to settle for this. And the moderates who weren't crazy about the whole thing and maybe wanted that tax break for small landlords, at least, who had rent-controlled units, decided not to advance that so they could advance a proposal to Beacon Hill.
I'm also getting a lot of texts from people who are landlords. You know, this one is said Brian from Holden. Oh, that's the wrong one. JP in Dorchester have 52 rental apartments, never raise the rent more than 5%, usually only after improvement has been made to the house. And another small landlord is talking about the constant need for updates of the house, spending tens of thousands of dollars to update things for the house and update things in the apartment, and how this person chooses their tenants very carefully and has kept the rents low because they are grateful for the good tenants that they have. So
well,
there
good
are
for them. That's great.
Yeah, there are two sides to the story, I think, that makes some small landlords nervous.
Well, also, by the way, a lot of landlords decide for strategic reasons, not just compassion, to keep rent increases relatively low because you want a stable, you want somebody who's a decent tenant, who's not driving you nuts, to stay there. And if it means you get a few extra dollars, most people I know who are landlords, very small landlords in Cambridge, that's their guiding notion. Benjamin in Salem, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, how you doing? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. The point I wanted to bring up is that I sit on the board of the local housing authority here, and it takes somebody, you know, at least 6 to 8 weeks to find a rental property, even if they have a Section 8 voucher. Mm-hmm. It might take longer. And one of the problems that we're seeing, which I don't see being addressed, like I have mixed feelings about rent control, but my biggest concern with it is that it would speed up the rate of condoization of existing structures.
Yeah, Marjorie mentioned that,
and
too.
And then that then decreases the overall rent available units for rental properties in the area. And when that happens, you know, we're not doing much to build more public housing units anymore. So the best thing that we can do is issue, you know, is issue Section 8 vouchers. But if there's less rental properties because they've gone condos, then that makes it so much harder for people to live here. And I just don't see that being talked much.
Well, Benjamin, can I interrupt you for a second? We did discuss that. I'm glad you brought it up. I forgot about it. There is a provision in Wu's proposal that doesn't prevent condo conversion, but provides some cushioning. And I think either Marjorie or I asked her about why she didn't go farther with that. And again, the legislature could amend it if they chose. Do you quickly, we only have a minute, do you quickly have a suggestion as to how that the condo conversion issue could be addressed other than outright prevention?
The only one that I can say is we have to encourage more low, small-scale development of housing properties in the area. I mean, smarter people than me have been looking at this for ages, and there's just not good solutions there except for we need more available units.
Of course. Benjamin, we appreciate your call. Thanks so much for bringing your perspective to this discussion.
Well, I think we can predict one thing, Jim.
What's that?
It's going to be a huge fight about this.
Well, you know, we forgot to play the sound we have. We'll maybe play it in a few minutes. Healy's on board. And we asked her about it as recently, Governor Healy, a week or so ago. And the question is she just going to say, if it gets to my desk, I'll sign it? A local option. And again, she wanted to see the details, but a local option, the concept she supported. Or is she going to join forces with Mayor Wu and the councilors and actually lobby it on Beacon Hill? We will ask the governor that next time she joins us.
Okay. We are going to move on. After the noon news, we're going to talk with the Boston Globe's Shirley Young about this issue, as Jim just said, plus Governor Healy's economic agenda, plus the state auditor investigating allegations of racism at the Heinz Convention Center Auditorium. All that is next. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
I'm Jim Brady, head on Boston Public Radio. Governor Healy's budget includes a proposal to make community college free. And the Supreme Court considers a proposal to make college even more expensive by killing Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. We'll speak with former Education Secretary Paul Revel about those things and college binge drinkers and the Borg.
I'm Marjorie Egan. The celebrity series of Boston Jazz Festival is on again. Singer Nina Freelon and violinist Chelsea Green will play as a tune or two in our studios in Brighton ahead of their concert tomorrow. We'll close the show with a question to listeners. Is it time to forget about decluttering queen Marie Kondo and re-embrace the mess? Especially if, like Kondo, you've now got a mess machine, kid or two, or teens with mushrooms growing in their bedrooms. It's all ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We want to remind everybody that we are going to be at the Boston Public Library tomorrow from 11 to 2, putting on our show.
Mm.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Marjorie. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
We're joined now on Zoom by Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung. She joins us weekly. Hello, Shirley.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hey,
hi.
Hey, Shirley Leung. So we just talked to our listeners for a half an hour about Mayor Wu's proposal for rent control, which has been approved by the city council, rent stabilization, she calls it. And to say the passions were intense on either side is an understatement. Tons of text messages about this. What's your takeaway? What do you think is going to happen with this whole proposal for rent stabilization in Boston?
Well, it's an early victory for Mayor Wu. I mean, she got it past the city council, but the real battle will be on Beacon Hill. Beacon Hill's notoriously does not, they don't, you know, they don't get a lot done to begin with, and especially with an incredibly controversial topic like this, they're going to find a way to like make this go away and not think about it, right? I mean, if you think about the real estate lobby, you know, they are already out in force. They've already spent hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to campaign and kill rent control on Beacon Hill. I mean, I think it's a fairly modest proposal that Mayor Wu put forth. I actually thought it would get killed at the city council because it was too modest. And so, but it's gone to the next round. And so I'm my sense is I think Beacon Hill will try to stall and try not to deal with it this session. But there is a pressure point. You're starting to see polling on the top.
Right. 3-1, 68-22 in the poll that was in Globe the other day.
Shirley, lots of people have written stories nationally about one of the big problems about big cities like Boston, New York, et cetera, is that we make it so hard to develop anything. The regulations are ridiculous. I mean, I wondered if there might be a way to kind of sweeten the pot for the development side, for the real estate side, where it wouldn't be so they might be more willing to make a compromise.
You know, I think that Mayor Wu's tried to do that with by exempting, you know, new construction, I think for the
15
first
years.
And so but ultimately, I mean, this rent control policy covers about half of the would apply to about half the units, the rentals in Boston. But ultimately, if you really want to lower rents, I mean, you got to increase supply. Got to find a way. And ultimately, I mean, you're right, Marjorie, one way is to create more incentives. But where we've seen the long jam is the neighborhood, right? The neighborhood by neighborhood, you know, whether it's in the city of Boston or out in the suburbs, no one seems to welcome new housing. You know, one of my favorite stories this year so far is by my colleague Andrew Brinker about the attempt to build apartments right on vacant parking spaces right on the South Shore Mall.
Right.
That seems like a great location to put more housing, right? It's right off of 93. You know, there seems to be a lot of land, but they're running into all kinds of problems trying to get more housing built on the parking lots of the South Shore Mall. One of the last stories Andrew wrote about was that I think they're trying to get Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll involved to kind of broker some kind of deal.
You know, I mentioned Governor Healey saying she supported local option. I just want to play the sound briefly before we leave this topic for today. In January, she's with us, and we ask her about whether she supports the concept of local option rent stabilization, rent control. Here it is.
From the beginning, my view has been, first of all, we've got a housing crisis. People can't afford rent. They can't afford to buy new homes. And this gets to whether or not people are going to be able to come here, stay here. I support the efforts of local communities to make decisions for themselves about what is going to work within their community. And so with every proposal, of course, the devil's always in the details. And
so you do support. Again, the devil is in the details, but the concept is one that obviously you're comfortable with and support.
The concept is, yes.
Okay, so the reason I play that is if you're worried about what happens, as Shirley said correctly, in the House and the Senate, the mayor of Boston supports it, the council supports it, the concept is supported by the governor. Call the governor's office and tell her you want her not just to sign it if it gets to her desk, but that you want her to lobby the legislature to get it to her desk. So that's it. We'll revisit this when we talk to both the governor and the mayor. We're talking to Shirley Leung from the Boston Globe.
Well, Shirley, it seems like everybody's going to be investigating the Heinz Convention Center Authority pretty soon after employees there alleged that there had been racism.
Not Heinz, the Convention
Center Authority. Convention Center Authority, involving hirings, postings, all this kind of stuff. We've got the investigation done by the Convention Center itself. The Attorney General is involved. Now we've got State Auditor Diana DiZoglio launching her audit of the Mass Convention Center Authority. So what do you make of this?
Oh, I was going to say, Marjorie is partially right. So the Mass Convention Center Authority oversees the Heinz, the South Boston Convention Center. So, but anyways, these are incredible allegations. And I'm glad that all the various authorities are investigating it. This comes at a time when, the state and the Convention Center Authority under, you know, previous Executive Director Jim Rooney, and a board, they've been very mindful and about looking at diversity in the supplier network. They've been looking at how can we attract more minority groups and convention goers of color to come to Boston. So there's been a lot of work put into this. And when I think about what's going on, I'm thinking about the NAACP convention. The Nationals convention is coming in July.
Exactly.
This was a time for us to show off Boston, how much we have changed. And so I'm working on a piece right now reminding, everyone that the governor actually has a lot of power here. She controls 9 of the 13 board seats of the Convention Center Authority. So, she should let these investigations play out, but they shouldn't take forever. You know, sometimes these investigations take forever. But this, you know, NAACP convention is coming to town very soon. I'm hoping that she can put some pressure to make sure that these are done properly, but also don't drag on.
You know, I don't understand about this, and you understand that world so much better than I. Just one paragraph from the Globe story. A Globe review found no black employees among the 25 highest paid employees of the Convention Authority. We're in a majority minority city. One of the few independent authorities in state government does not have a diversity officer even charged with creating opportunities. Authority officials, this is the one that kills me, say they're now in the process of hiring their first diversity officer. Of course they are, because they're being accused of discriminating against people and of discriminating against black people in particular.
They're forced to sign these non-disclosure agreements too in some cases when they leave, right? Which is kind of, I don't know, is that weird?
Well, I think the non-disclosure is probably a somewhat of a standard practice, but in addition to the lack of diversity, there are no highly paid people of color, among the top 25, is that the board itself
always
is not
asking
diverse.
Questions.
How do I choose which story leads to pursue?
Whoops.
Oh, Philip Martin decided to join the show.
Hi,
from
Philip.
Some. Okay. As you were saying, a little technical snafu there.
I was saying that the board itself, the reason why I bring up the board is because you guys don't remember, but one of the very first things that Governor Baker did when he became governor was that he remade the board. He in overnight, 7 new board members, mm-hmm. and including a new board chair. But the previous board was very diverse. There were 4 people of color on that board. Michelle Shell, a black woman, was the chair of the board. Many of them were Deval Patrick appointees. When Baker remade the board, right now, there's only 1 black board member on the board.
Really? I didn't know that.
So I think this is an opportunity for Healy to take a look at the board to make sure that the board is diverse as these investigations play out.
You know, my favorite part of the story in the Globe reporting.
Andrew Estes did it, by the way.
Great reporter, obviously, as I think we say pretty regularly. You mentioned the non-disclosure agreement, Margie. Natasha Hall was required to sign a non-disclosure agreement, employees said. But they learned how much the confidential settlement was anyway. $1.2 million because someone left a copy on an office printer.
That was a great detail
that
in her story.
Wasn't
so that a great
totally
detail?
Totally great.
And, okay. Do you think somebody did that on purpose? What do you think?
I wonder. I wonder if that is the case.
Yeah. Maybe. Wow. $1.2 million. Okay. So Shirley Young, let us.
By the way, the other thing, reason that's relevant is Diana DeSaglio's built her whole career
on non-disclosures,
on being anti-non-disclosure agreements around issues like sexual harassment and that sort of thing. When she was a House member and a senator.
When you say there's standard operating procedure, why? I don't understand that, Shirley.
Well, no, I'm just saying that NDA, usually you get something happens, nobody, you know, they want to kind of sweep it under the rug. So yeah. We'll give you money and we'll pay you to go away. I mean, that's, okay.
We don't admit guilt, of course, and that sort of thing, right?
So to get your money, you got to sign on the dotted line.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Unless it's left on the copy machine.
And by the way, there are people like DiSaglio, again, who pretty much ran on this, that said they should be outlawed in many contexts so that employees are not in that position.
One of the reasons it took decades to find out about the priests, right, the Catholic Church, was they were all, these people were all getting, not signing non-disclosure agreements, which you can understand maybe then in that context. They didn't want to be, have their stories of sexual abuse when they were children on the front page of the paper. But it did mean that this conduct continued, and the public was unaware. Okay, Shirley Young, what do we think about what Healy has done on fixing the economy or keeping it chugging along at a good pace?
Well, we talked a little bit about this last week, but the reason why we're talking about again is because my colleague Larry Edelman is launching a new business newsletter. A shameless plug here.
It's fine.
It's called Trend Lines, and it's coming out Monday and Fridays. And his first piece was about talking to the business community and what they think about Healy's first budget. And we talked a little bit about this last week. She is really taking a page from Charlie Baker. She's a true moderate when it comes to the economy. And I know the business community is very, largely pleased with the budget, including estate tax reform and some other tax cuts. Though in Larry's new inaugural newsletter, I think some people in the business community thought that she could have gone a bit further, even though she's proposing estate tax reform and lowering some of these capital gains, short-term capital gains tax. It really just puts us in line with everybody else. It doesn't make us more competitive on that front or give us an advantage.
You know, Shirley Young, you wrote a great column about the interviewing the former state labor secretary. We all remember back during the pandemic, things closed. People were in desperate shape. They had no money. The state starts giving out all this money so people could buy food, et cetera. And then the rules changed. And then the state was told they had to get back, I think it was, as you put out your column, $4 billion clawed back from the people who probably didn't have it anymore because they'd already spent the money and the food and the bills and stuff like that. And your quote from her that she said, it was like the Hunger Games out there with every state trying to like fend for itself. Elaborate on this. It was a great column.
Right. So, we were talking about this about
yes,
exactly a year ago. We were talking about because what was happening was that people who had applied for unemployment benefits during the pandemic starting to get notices from the state, you owe us money, and sometimes tens of thousands of dollars because the federal government, which, the state just helps dispense these benefits, the federal government changed the rules on who qualified. And so a lot of people were really worried. They really did not have money to give back. And so and you I was going to say you and Jim did a great job of grilling the governor a year ago about, are you really clawing back the money? And remember, he took umbrage with that.
That's like, right. He didn't like. Not a clawback.
Not a clawback. I mean, technically, they had not. They wanted their money back, but I guess in his mind, clawback was that we would take your tax refund, we would intercept your paychecks or intercept your tax refund. But, anyways, Rosalind Acosta, the labor secretary at the time, she is now at she left the administration. She's a new job. I don't think she's ever really talked about what happened, and so now she's at a consulting firm, EY. But it was an opportunity to kind of catch up, like what happened to all that money. And it turns out,
by the way,
out,
this affected hundreds of thousands of people.
Oh
this
yeah,
is no
right, hundreds
small
of thousands
deal,
of
right? Okay.
And actually, they did. So what happened was after Larry and me writing the stories about you grilling the governor, the state, the governor put out this basically, it's not really somewhat of an amnesty, but basically what they call a one-click waiver. They made it very easy for you to get through, to appeal, to apply for a waiver. And when all, and so far, so there was about $4 billion in overpayments. And through this kind of very kind of easier process, the state was able to process 418,000 claims and about over $3 billion in overpayments. So, but as I've learned, since learned, there's still people out there who are still going through this process. And this, the one-click waiver, that that period, these were emergency regulations, they expired in October. So I think some of the advocates are trying to get those regulations back in place, because it was night and day. It made it, you know, maybe it would take weeks to process your waiver and your appeal. You know, it takes seconds, apparently, under those emergency regulations. But so one of the things, though, I asked Acosta, I said, has the state started to intercept tax refunds yet? And she said, when I left, they have not. And I did confirm with the state, they have not started to intercept tax refunds. But I think some of the lawyers working on this issue are fear that that's coming, you know.
You know, by the
3 years after the pandemic.
Two things that just a comment on what you said. There, word on the street, Marjorie knows this too, it was immediately after that grilling that we did of Charlie Baker that he decided he would not seek a third term. I don't know if you're aware of that. I can't either confirm or but on a serious note, I don't know if it was you or Larry wrote it for people. First of all, it was through no fault of their own that they got
yeah,
that
it was
money.
Terrible.
I want to emphasize this thing. If either your story, Shirley, or Larry's stories, the terror that people felt after they got these benefits that they thought they were getting,
because they
were entitled to,
they were out of
and
work.
After they used it for necessities in 99.9% of the cases, hanging over their head, the thought that they'd have to pay back, as you say, in some cases, tens of thousands of dollars. It's not just the economic impact, fiscal economic impact that's huge, the psychic impact on people who were struggling to begin with during the pandemic was just, it was a harsh show. So
it was, yeah. And they spent, and we, you know, Larry originally broke the story and then we paired up together to talk to people who were affected, and it was so stressful. And you know, they felt like, listen, the state approved the money, you know, it wasn't an act of fraud. They said they were
exactly
okay.
Right.
They used to, you know, pay their rent, put food on their table. And so what we're finding now is some of the lingering cases is that, you know, people applied for unemployment back in, I don't know, 2020, 2021. Now it's 2023. They've gone back. They haven't checked their unemployment accounts. They've been back to work. They think that, you know, everything is normal. And suddenly some of them, they went to just happen to check their unemployment benefit account. And they're like, oh, no, what? I owe tens of thousands of dollars. And so I'm going to revisit the issue.
Great.
Because for some people, it's still very much a problem.
Yeah,
and
I
was just going to say, there were lots of people that got away with unemployment fraud, too, claiming other people's names for unemployment and that
right.
sort of thing, which really, I don't know how they resolved those issues or how they ever got the money back or if they ever arrested anybody. But wasn't that rampant during the pandemic, too?
Yeah, and with the
PPP
loans,
yeah.
Right? But that's going through the courts. I mean, those are criminal cases going through. But that's not these people. These are
upstanding people.
Right.
We don't know if they're upstanding. We just know they were entitled. They
some
thought they were entitled to the money. And
some of them are upstanding. Some of them are between shady and upstanding. We're not really sure.
I'm glad you did a follow-up on that. Can I ask one last question about this? Because I wasn't clear when you said. When you said the current administration, I don't even know. What's the name of the new labor? Lauren somebody?
Lauren Jones.
Lauren Jones.
Yes.
My apology to the secretary. I just forgot her last name. You learned that they're not doing any of these holding back your tax refunds or anything.
Oh, no.
Go ahead.
I should say they have not started.
Well, that's why I wanted to ask you. Is it their intention to do it?
Well, that what I was told is they have not. They have not started intercepting tax refunds. So for example, let's say you owe $10,000, they're going to dock your tax refund. Uh-huh. But they haven't. That process is currently under review. Whether they would begin that process of intercepting tax refunds.
Okay, glad you followed up on it, Shirley. It's great to see you.
Thank you very much, as always, Shirley.
Thanks for having me.
You know everything over there. She's a business columnist.
Talking to me, you're talking to Shirley.
I'm talking to Shirley, actually.
Oh, Shirley, I'm sorry.
She knows everything.
Okay,
Shirley Young is a business columnist for the Boston Globe and a weekly BPR contributor. Thank you very much, Shirley. After a quick break, it's Women's History Month. And so in honor of that, we're going to revisit a 2014 conversation we had with former President Jimmy Carter, who is now in hospice care, as you probably know. This is a book he wrote about violence against women, not just in the United States, but all around the world, just a few years back. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. That conversation with Jimmy Carter is up next.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. As you know, Jimmy Carter is the oldest living American president at 98. He recently moved into hospice care, opting to spend his remaining time at home with his family. Marjorie and I were lucky enough to speak to President Carter from when we were at GBH back in 2014. He was only 90 years old at the time, about a book he wrote. It's called A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. Gender equality is one of the many important causes President Carter has championed in and out of office, even when it was not terribly popular. His White House supported the Equal Rights Amendment, and his administration was noted for its inclusion of women. For President Carter, equality is not simply about politics, but about theology. Since it's Women's History Month, we thought we'd re-listen to our 2014 conversation with the 39th President of the United States. President Carter, pleasure to talk to you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jim, and Marjorie, too, I guess.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be talking with you, President Carter. So as people know, you've not only won the Nobel Peace Prize, but you've written more than 24 best-selling books. Why did you decide to focus on the problem of women and girls being discriminated against around the world? Why did you choose that subject?
Well, because we decided after 4 years of study that it's the most important and unaddressed and serious affliction of human rights on Earth. There's no doubt about it. The abuse of women and girls in the United States and other nations is almost beyond comprehension. And I thought it was very important to let not only the public officials know about these abuses that are not addressed, are not corrected, but also to let the private citizens of our country know what's going on here in America and in other countries.
You know, President Carter, after having read your book this weekend, I was watching 60 Minutes last night. I don't know if you saw it, but the cardinal from Boston was very close to the Pope, Sean O'Malley, was being interviewed by Nora O'Donnell. And the line that made me think of you after having read the book is Cardinal Sean says, not everyone needs to be ordained to have an important role in the life of the church. Women run Catholic charities, Catholic schools, development office, the archdiocese. It goes on to say priests can't have children. You think that a lot of the discrimination and subjugation of women trickles down from bias at the top in religions in the world, correct?
It does, yes.
And explain it
to
us again.
Well, I wrote the Pope a letter after I published my book, and I sent him a copy of it, by the way, and he sent me a very nice letter saying that his opinion was that women's involvement in the leadership roles of the church should be enhanced or increased. He didn't say how, of course, and I think that what Archbishop or Cardinal O'Malley said last night is true. I think that the Pope is inclined to improve the women's status in the church. But still, the Southern Baptist Convention, from which I withdrew about 12, 15 years ago in protest because they ordained that women couldn't be pastors and deacons and couldn't be chaplains in the military, was directly contrary to what I believed back in those ancient times. So I think that this is a problem in all religions. We work very closely with the Grand Imam of the major university in Cairo, Egypt, who is the leader of the Sunni Muslims, and he agrees with us, and he has issued his own edicts, that there's no place in the Islamic world to derogate women or treat them as inferior to men. So I think that this is an unfortunate interpretation that has been handed down through the centuries, and now it looks on, you know, it's assumed almost a matter of theological authentication.
But President Carr, correct me if I'm wrong, you believe that the impact, it's not just within the religion that there is discrimination,
right.
that sort of discrimination essentially gives tacit permission for men to abuse wives and children and that sort of thing, correct?
That's exactly right. And even employers who are dealing with equity among their pay scale, for instance, if they want to pay a woman a little bit less, if they are religious or not, they can use a belief that women are inferior in the eyes of God to treat them as inferior people in the marketplace or in employment pools. And, of course, in some countries in the world, there's a big article in the New York Times this morning about the genital mutilation of women. In Egypt, for instance, 91% of all the women over 17 years of age have been genitally mutilated, with a misinterpretation of the Quran and also the Bible, neither one of which calls for that to be done. So it's a very serious problem, and a lot of times we don't prosecute men who perpetrate rape or other crimes against women, and that applies in the universities of America and also in the military of the United States as well as in other countries.
You know, we want to get to both the military in the United States and the universities in just one second, President Carter, but I'm curious, as you well know better than I do, that some religions, Reformed Judaism, for example, and some Protestant denominations, Episcopalians, and there are many others, have ordained rabbis in the case of Jews and ministers in the case of the
not
Protestants.
Orthodox Jews, by the way.
Not Orthodox, just Reform, is what I said, Reform Judaism. So the question is, are these people just ahead of their time and other people going to follow, or do you think that this is going to be decades and decades before we see changes in some of these other religions?
I think there's a trend to do it. For instance, I belong to a little church in Plains. In fact, I teach Bible lessons every Sunday, including yesterday. Well, we've had a woman pastor, and where my wife, Rosen, has been a deacon in the church, and where my sister-in-law has been the chairman of the board of deacons. But anyway, and we noticed that in some of the major churches, in the Methodist Church and also in the Episcopalian Church and others, they are now moving toward ordaining women as bishops in the church as well as pastors in the church. So I think there's a trend in the right direction, but still it's very slow coming.
You know, you mentioned the military a minute ago, and obviously you were a veteran. We had Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas with us, I don't know, 2-3 weeks ago, who's been working with the senator from New York and a Republican whose name I forgot. I think it's Turner from Ohio. On this whole thing, the numbers, at least the public numbers, and I assume the private ones are worse, about sexual abuse and sexual harassment in the military are absolutely stunning in this country in 2014. What does one do about that?
Well, as you know, some of the women in a U.S. Senate earlier this year tried to correct it, and the Department of Defense reported that there were 26,000 cases of sexual assault in the military during the previous year. I think it's 2012. And of those 26,000, only 3,000, which is about 1%, were ever brought to any form of justice to prosecute the perpetrator of a rape or other sexual abuse. And the reason for that disparity is that commanding officers in the military can prevent or any sort of prosecution of a rapist. And I know I've served on a submarine. I've served two or three submarines and on two battleships. And I know that a commanding officer of a ship does not want it to be known that under his command there are sexual assaults taking place. And the same thing applies, obviously, in an Army troop or a brigade U.S. Marines. The commanding officers don't want it to be known that under their command these kind of crimes are taking place. So they prevent the woman from reporting, first of all, with various kinds of persuasion. And then they also can actually... If a man is found guilty in the military, the commanding officer can actually give him a pardon unilaterally so he won't be punished. Same thing is happening, by the way, in the universities of America.
We had we're talking with former President Jimmy Carter. Speaking of the universities, President Carter, right today on the front page of the Boston Globe here is another story about sexual assault policy at Harvard University. It's been a big controversy. The New York Times had a big front page and the Week in Review section yesterday talking about the same thing, yeah. that we have very few convictions and women are not reporting rape, et cetera, the same old story. So we're in a dilemma right here at some of the finest colleges and universities in America.
Well, I've been a professor at Emory University for 33 years, and I know it goes on the Emory campus as well. There again, you know, the president of a university and the deans of a university are very averse to it being known how many sexual assaults take place on the campuses. And I read the article, excuse me, in the New York Times, and I noticed, and I've also got in my book, by the way, that only about less than 5% of all the sexual assault cases or rapes on college campuses are ever reported by women. Whereas in outside university life, say in normal life in Boston or Atlanta, about 35% are reported. So that shows how much of a deterrent there is on a college campus for a woman to report that she's been raped. And when it is reported, very seldom nothing is done about it, except just they counsel the rapist. And I noticed also in an article that was in the New York Times yesterday that men, about 4% of the men of the college campuses are ever involved in this kind of crime. And the average serial rapist on a college campus has perpetrated 6 rapes, mm-hmm. As reported by the U.S. Department of Justice. So the whole thing is just in abeyance right now, and I hope that my book and other articles that have come out this year now will bring about some correction to this problem.
We're talking to President Jimmy Carter. His new book is A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. You know, I was going to wait till the end of the interview to ask you this question, but I can't stand it anymore. President Carter, you are 90 years old. You sound fantastic. I've seen you on television. You look fantastic. So what's going on? Is it clean living down there in Plains, Georgia? Is it a long marriage? I mean, what's the secret?
Well, I married the right woman. That's the major thing. And I've been... You know, I've been with her for 68 and a half years. And so that's one of the reasons I get along so well. But I've been lucky, as a matter of fact, with my health. You know, a lot of people, through no fault of our own, are stricken down in life a lot earlier. But I've just been fortunate.
Yeah, a lot of people think your wife was pretty fortunate in her selection, too, President
Are you
Carter.
Doing the elliptical in the morning? Or what? You know, what are you doing?
Well, I get up early. I write a lot. I've been writing on my next book this morning, and that's the way I make a living is on my books. I don't serve on corporate boards, and I'm not on the lecture circuit. So, and I get a salary from my teaching job at Emory, which gives me some time to write. So I enjoy the exploration of ideas, and also appreciate when I write a book the chance to talk to people like you, and promulgate, you know, my ideas and try to bring about some changes in the world that I think are important.
You know, you also write about infanticide, and it really hits home with me. Both of my daughters are adopted from China roughly 20 years ago. And when the adoption of Chinese girls in America started in earnest roughly 20 years ago, yeah. virtually everybody would say to me, why are they all girls? And they're all girls because they're the lucky ones, as you know, because there
they
is a huge amount of infanticide in Asia. Is this as prevalent today as it was 20 and 30 years ago?
It is. As a matter of fact, in China now, for every 100 girls, there are 118 boys.
Yeah.
And in India, there are 114 boys for every 100 girls. And what happens to those other 18% of girls who would be born? They are actually murdered or strangled by their own parents. And this happens not only when the governments like India and China put a limit on the number of people in a family, but it also happens when in other countries where there's extreme poverty and the parents don't think they can support, say, 5 or 6 children. They want to have maybe 2 boys or 1 boy grow up to take care of them in their old age. So this means that in the world now, there are 160 million girls missing from the face of the earth, and they have either been aborted before they are born, or either they've been strangled at birth. There was a movie that came out last year, about a year ago now, called It's a Girl.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a woman from India in the movie who testifies quite proudly. As a matter of fact, she strangled 8 daughters because she and her husband couldn't afford to raise them.
You know, President Carter, the current president, Barack Obama, just cut a deal with the president of China on climate change. And in those kinds of meetings, I always wonder what people who've achieved those positions like you had, how do you make the determination when there's an issue like climate change, for example, which obviously is a pretty critical one as well. And at the same time, you're aware, and I'm sure the president is aware, even if he hasn't read your book yet, about what's going on with little girls in that country. How did you make the decision about what was the right time and the right circumstance to raise issues like human rights, which I know have really been your life's work? How'd you make that decision?
Well, I emphasize human rights even when it was very unpopular back in those days. For instance, just give you one quick example. It had been a policy in our country for decades, even centuries, to go to bed with the military dictators in Latin America. And we would have very lucrative trades with them on getting bauxite or iron ore or pineapples or bananas or whatever. And if any revolutionaries wanted to change their government to a democracy, they were characterized by the United States leaders as communists. And we were even sending troops to defend the military dictators. I changed that. And when I was became president, there were military dictatorships, as you may know, in Honduras and in Guatemala and Nicaragua and in Chile and Argentina and Paraguay and Uruguay and Peru and Brazil. All of those were military dictators. But after the human rights policy was implemented, and I insisted on it, within 10 years, every one of those countries had become a democracy. Just because the people were given a chance to express their views peacefully, and they prevailed. So I think that human rights ought always to be should be in the forefront of the considerations that we maintain. But obviously that can't prevent you trying to deal with global warming and the search for peace and so forth.
We're talking with President Jimmy Carter. His new book is A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. President Carter, speaking of sending in troops, you have written a lot about, obviously, violence in the world as well, and we are now in a position where we are sending more troops into Iraq. As you know, Peter Kasich, the young American, was beheaded by ISIS, and
yes,
people are still reeling from that. But you were president for a long time, President Carter. What do you think? Should we be sending more troops into Iraq as we are right now?
Well, I don't want to comment on that, on what we should be doing now. But I know that when I was president, I looked on human rights as a major factor. But also the right of people to live in peace is one of the most crucial elements of human rights. And so I just relegated going to war as the last possible option that I would exercise in any sort of crisis that involved our country. And while I was in office, we not only kept peace for our own country, but we tried to promote peace for others, like between Egypt and Israel, and normalize relations with China and doing away with apartheid in Rhodesia and things of that kind. So I was lucky to go through my term in office. We never dropped a bomb or fired a missile or, you know, or shot a bullet. So I think in general we should have as going to war as the last possible decision to make for a country in a time of crisis. Most of the wars that we've been in since the Second World War, and that's been about 30 different wars against different people, have been unnecessary. Some of them obviously have to be classified as justified.
You know, President Carter, one of the last things from me, if I can. You write in your book that we can't, and I'll paraphrase, I know you'll correct me if I'm wrong or overstating it, we can't impose our standards from outside on how women should be treated, that essentially we have to work with local women leaders and let them be the ones who help transform their culture. Is that a fair description of what you wrote?
It is when you relate it to genital mutilation, yes.
So,
because it's the mothers in Egypt, for instance, and in Somalia and Djibouti who mutilate the sexual organs of their little girls, more than 90% of the women, and that's a decision that's not imposed on the women by their husbands or by the religious leaders, but it's done by women, and that's a particular issue where women make the decision. by having the Quran and the Bible, by the way, misinterpreted to convince them that their daughter's genitals must be mutilated so they won't be have sexual satisfaction and so forth.
So is it too broad a leap for me to draw from that example that you wrote about that the same rule should apply to the United States attempting to impose democracies in parts of the world where local leaders are not fighting for democracies, but because we think it's best for them, we should try to make it happen?
If you use the word impose, I would agree with you completely. I think we can encourage democracy. In fact, the Carter Center does that, and it was a policy that I adopted when I left the White House. We began the policy, which has now been adopted by others, of monitoring democratic elections in troubled countries.
Mm-hmm.
We just finished our 98th election a week or two ago in Tunisia, and we'll do our 99th election this week with the election of a president in Tunisia. Earlier last few months, we've been to Madagascar and Mozambique, for instance. So we help with elections all over the world, but we only go in at the invitation of the country involved, and we have to comply and do comply with their rules and regulations. Sometimes their rules and regulations preclude any of the basic elements of a democracy, like in Egypt. We were going to monitor the next election in Egypt, but I decided that Egypt didn't have the basic principles of democracy available to their people in the upcoming election, so we withdrew in protest. So I think from the United States, particularly in a non-governmental organization like the Carter Center, you can promote the concepts of democracy or explain to the people, not with intrusion, but mm-hmm. in answer to their questions and so forth, the advantages of letting the people choose their own leaders.
We're talking with President Jimmy Carter. You talk, as you just mentioned, about encouraging democracies in other countries. In your book, Call to Action, you suggest other steps, 23 other steps, actually, that can help blaze the road to progress. Anything particular in the last minute or so that you would like to point out to people to remember?
Well, I think the best thing to remember is how serious, for instance, one that we haven't mentioned is slavery. We have a higher level of income from world slavery now than we did even during the time of the 17th and 18th centuries, or even 19th centuries, in the United States and other places with Africans brought to the New World. The State Department now is required in the United States by the Congress Act to describe slavery in our country, and they report that in the last year, data, I think it was 2013, there's 60,000 people living in the United States in slavery and human bondage. And in Atlanta is the number one trading post for people coming into this country from others and sold into slavery. About 80% of them are girls sold into sexual slavery. In an average month in Atlanta, between 200 and 300 girls come into the Atlanta airport and are sold primarily to brothel owners. And this is the reason for it is Atlanta is the busiest airport by far in the world, and a lot of our passengers come in from the southern hemisphere where their skin is brown or black. So a brown or black skinned girl can be sold into a brothel in Atlanta or surrounding cities for just $1,000. And everybody in America, including in Boston and Atlanta, know when a whorehouse or brothel is in operation. There's no way that you can conceal that from the local police on the block. And they either are bribed or they get free sexual slavery favors, or they are told by their chief of police and therefore the mayor and city council, let's don't rock the boat on a whorehouse because that's what the men want, and it doesn't do any real bad consequences. But the problem is that a lot of those girls who are sold or in prostitutes were sold into slavery originally or still are forced into slavery, against their will. Sweden, by the way, is doing something to correct it, and I've been working with the parliaments in France and in Ireland and in Canada who are contemplating adopting the Swedish model. They don't arrest the prostitutes like we do in America. They arrest the brothel owners, the pimps, and the male customers.
That was the voice of former President Jimmy Carter. He spoke with us back in 2014 about his book, A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. Carter is now 98 years old. He recently moved into hospice care. We're thinking of him, his family, his wife, and what a wonderful, inspiring example he has been, the life he's lived post his presidency. After a quick break, Foreign Massachusetts Education Secretary Paul Revel is here. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. We are live at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. You know, just listening to President Carter. He was 90 years old when we did that interview. He is one incredible man. We're joined now by Paul Revel. Paul is the former Secretary of Education for Massachusetts, professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also leads the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, co-authored with Lynn Sachs, is Collaborative Action for Equity and Opportunity, A Practical Guide for School and Community Leaders. Hello, Paul Revel.
Hello, Jim and Marjorie. Sorry I can't be there with you.
That's okay.
Paul, we've had over the years several stories about racism in Everett, some involving city councilors, some involving charges against the mayor. And now we've had another one where a highly regarded, apparently, superintendent did not get her contract renewed. She is alleging racism against the mayor, and so is one of her underlings, which is very disruptive, I guess, to these kids. But Jim has pointed out that there's also an odd lack of reaction from other people around the state, either in politics or in education, about what's happening over there in Everett. It's sort of stunning, the silence, really.
Yeah, it's a surprising situation because it really smells. I mean, every aspect of this. I mean, you have a superintendent here who received consistently positive evaluations from everyone on the school committee since being appointed in 2019, including the mayor, up until the point in which she filed a suit for discrimination and retaliation against him. And as you pointed out, somebody else did. I give credit to the head of the state superintendent's organization, Tom Scott, came forward on her behalf, and they never really do that, so that's unusual. She had received a prize from that organization. Yeah. And particularly coming on the heels of their last long-term superintendent for decades, having been in jail over sexual assault charges and facing some other ones that he's already admitted guilt to. I mean, it's a really checkered history there. And so for them to, in full public view and amidst rumors that people on the school committee were getting payoffs in terms of jobs and things of that nature in return for their votes, they denied it. But nonetheless, I mean, it just leaves a really bad taste in everybody's mouth. And I can't explain why other leaders haven't been speaking out on her behalf. But she certainly seems like a victim here.
Well, the other thing is, who is going to take a job there now? What superintendent that's a good quality person is going to want to come into the city of Everett after reading about this?
Short answer, nobody. I mean, why would you? It just, you know, unless you're part of the kind of old boy network, which seems to be getting reinforced there, you know, maybe you'll find somebody of that ilk, but you're not going to find, you know, an education leader. You're not going to find somebody who reflects the demographics of the children in the school system. I mean, this was the first woman of color, this is the first person of color, first woman, as far as I understand it, ever to lead the Everett Public Schools. High time that they needed that kind of diversity. When she came into office, nobody in the central office was of color. People were all white in a district that's 80% minority. I mean, you know, something's got to give, and this is really a problem. And I'm sorry there hasn't been more comment from our top state officials on this.
So are we. So in Boston, we've had this discussion before. I think this is, we come down two against one. I would be the one. The city council said, let's honor the public mandate in an advisory ballot question, where overwhelmingly the people of Boston said, we want an elected school committee. And if people are not aware, to my knowledge, every single city and town in Massachusetts has an elected school committee except one. That'd be Boston. Mayor Wu vetoed it and said respectfully, and she'd use the word, she doesn't think it's the right time to be doing this, even though she had talked about the possibility of a hybrid kind of thing, part elected, part appointed. Paul, I believe you believe this is the right choice. If you do, why is it the right choice? One, because we're the outlier in Boston, and two, because the people spoke.
Well, I mean, Boston has always appealed to state government for exceptionalism by being the state capital city and the largest city. So I'm not, you know, and mayoral control of education is something that, you know, nationally, only a few of the larger cities have done it. So that's not surprising. I do think it's the right thing, really, for two sort of significant reasons right now. Number one, because we have a new mayor and because we have a superintendent in Mary Skipper, who's inspiring a lot of confidence about her capacity to bring about the changes, I think that at least putting a pause on it at this moment and giving this new administration a chance to use the powers that they have and the coherency that you get for having the mayor and the superintendent on the same page, I think would be a wise idea in any event, even if you were in favor of this measure in the long term. I'm not in favor of it. I'm old enough to know the history of the Boston School Committee. It was a disaster prior to this change being made toward mayoral control and mayoral appointment. The committee now is far more demographically representative of the population in the Boston public schools than it ever was. We don't have the kind of divisiveness. We had a 13-member committee back when this happened. You had some elected at large, four, I think. You had nine elected by district, so therefore their concerns were about their district rather than about the city as a whole. You had blatant racism and broad dysfunction, rapid turnover in superintendents.
There was a lot of racism on the appointed committee in the last 18 months, by the way. Those comments that were picked up by the chair and others, no?
Fair point. But, I mean, it was just the idea that this is a kind of a silver bullet remedy. It's just sort of, I think, careening from one pillar to another and the pendulum swinging backwards. So I don't think it's the answer to what's going on in the Boston public schools. I think we need, you know, strong management. I think we need to focus on student achievement. We need to attend to populations that like English language learners and special needs students who've been underserved. We need to do something about our high schools. There's a whole agenda of less glamorous, less sort of topical subjects than the authority of who runs the school system to be attending to. And thank God we have a superintendent who's focused on that now.
Yeah, you know, early in my career, I covered a lot of school committee meetings, and I was usually horrified by the corruption and the, I mean, a lot of school committees spend a lot of time giving people jobs, and that's not always a great thing to be doing. Their focus was on that and not on the schools. And what would the platforms be in Boston, Jim? I'm running for the MCAS. I'm running against the MCAS. I'm running for
what are the
schools.
Platforms
I'm
in the 350
them.
Cities and towns that have elected school committees now?
Well, I'm not out there. I'm not
investigating. You live in one community where they have them, and I live in one community.
Yeah, well,
people.
In Brookline, we have a town meeting thing, so you can't even vote on some of these things unless you're a town meeting member. But I just think it's they're ripe for trouble.
The other concern that I have is just this, you know, this will become, you know, the hottest topic in education in Boston and will suck up all the oxygen that needs to be more focused on, you know, on strategy, on what we're doing to solve persistent problems that are, you know, having the most profound negative effect on students in the Boston public schools who aren't being well served, because we'll talk about this ad infinitum. Because it's the kind of thing that's easy for everybody to talk about. It's about authority and who has control and so on and so forth. But I don't think it's the most important thing for us to be focused on right
Paul,
now.
Paul, one last quick thing about this. If part of the goal is to know where the buck stops, at least I think that's part of the reason why I would support, which I don't. But if I were to support an appointed school committee, I would say the good news is you may not know who the school committee member you voted for is, but the good news is you know who the mayor is. If that's the case and the buck stops with the mayor in Boston because it's an appointed committee, why do we even have a committee? Why don't we have an education secretary, which or some such thing, which I'm sure is in her cabinet, and the mayor and her education person runs the schools? Because I'm assuming people appointed by the mayor generally do what the mayor wants them to do. No.
Yeah, no, that's true. And in some jurisdictions with mayoral control, you do have that form of government. You don't really have an intervening panel, but for the most part, you do. And I think it's a good idea. That's how you get broader representation and participation from the community. You have regular meetings that are open to the public and people can come and testify. Mm-hmm. The mayor doesn't want to be the chief executive of the school system, but the mayor wants to have a sort of control over, broadly speaking, policy and major strategies that are implemented. So I think having a board so that the community has a regular way to interact with the school system and members of that committee who have power and authority. I mean, they can have their own views on what needs to be done. And those views sometimes, incidentally, depart from the mayor's view on what needs to be done. So I think it's a good intermediary body that ensures community participation.
We're talking with Paul Revel, our education man. You know, I'm not in favor of illegal teacher strikes.
However, the
teachers in Woburn had a very good point when they were fighting, at least in part, for higher pay for the paraprofessionals in the classroom. They deal a lot of times with kids with special needs. They help out the teachers. I was stunned to learn that in Quincy and New Bedford, apparently, these paraprofessionals don't even get the minimum wage in the classroom. The Globe story pointed out to, I think it was Lexington, where this teacher that was a paraprofessional was getting $38,000 a year, less than half the average teacher's salary there. So there's a legitimate problem with pay for these paraprofessionals, it seems to me.
No question. I mean, that same article points out that 85% of the paras statewide make less than $30,000.
Yeah. So
38,000, 85% making less than 30. So, yeah, it's a poverty wage. And they're having to work other jobs or having to go on welfare or food stamps or whatever to provide for themselves. And it's just
awful.
You know, they're part of the educational equation. So I think it's a perfectly legitimate issue for for the MTA to be working on and bargaining for. And, we've become increasingly dependent as a special education population has increased in Massachusetts. The degree of need has increased and the pressure for inclusion, which means moving students with disabilities into the mainstream, has increased. You can't do that properly unless you have paras. So we absolutely need them. And particularly in these times of labor shortages, I know that districts are having difficulty attracting people to these roles, and part of that problem is undeniably the lack of adequate pay for them. So it's an important issue.
Just to add to what Marjorie said about Woburn and that illegal strike in Malden that some people I know thought was horrible, paraprofessionals want a 24% increase in wages in the first year of the new contract. So,
well, I'm very happy for them. That well-deserved pay raise, Jim. Mm.
Mm-hmm. It was a central issue in the illegal strike, Marjorie.
It was an illegal strike.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just a matter of fact, Jim, right? I mean, it is illegal, but you know, that's another question. I mean, that's a whole separate question. Should we have legal strikes of public employees, and is that a good thing? That's a different question in my mind. Should we pay fairly these paraprofessionals? And you know, plaudits to the MTA for standing up for them. I mean, I'm not always in support of what the MTA is pushing for, but this kind of thing, I really think is the right.
You know, next time you're here, let's talk about the strike issue, which Governor Healey has weighed in on and said she is not supportive of the MTA legislation.
We did. We talked about the strike issue a couple of weeks ago. We had a big fight about it. Yeah, we did. The three of us.
Well, let's do it again then.
It's an interesting Commonwealth Magazine. Michael Jonas did a good piece on this recently, saying that, you know, the farther people were from the front lines of education, the more likely they were to lend their support to the idea of strikes. The closer people are, you know, if you get down to the level of Maura Healey or Jeff Riley, the less likely they are to support the idea that, parents and students should be pushed out of school over bargaining issues.
Well
said, Paul Revel.
Well,
how about that, Jim?
For some of us who have been in strike in the quasi-public sector earlier in our lives, sometimes the students and the clients actually benefit from that decision to...
Well, I'm not sure the students do. The teachers do. I'm not sure the students do.
Well, I would say if you have paraprofessionals, for example, in Malden, we just talked about making a living wage as opposed to before, I would say there are two beneficiaries, the paraprofessionals and the kids to whom they provide services, don't you think?
Okay, Jim.
Thank you.
I think that's true. The question is an illegal strike necessary to get to that place?
Well,
yes. We can have a knockdown drag out next time.
Well, I think we should.
You know, Paul's here for a nice, pleasant interview, not another
battle royale. Let's do that next time.
You and me.
Let's do that.
Okay. Yeah. So the governor has gotten some kudos for her new budget proposal, making a college more affordable, especially community college. So tell us what she's doing and what you think of it.
Well, I mean, the governor, does deserve the plaudits on this. I mean, I think it's high time that we do something about, the finance of higher education. And, what I like about the governor's approach generally in her budget, and particularly with regard to education and higher education specifically, is that she's really focused in on this notion of competitiveness. It will, Massachusetts is only going to have an economic future if we have a highly educated workforce that can solve problems and provide expertise that can't be found in other places around the country, other places that will be a lot less expensive in which to locate a business. So if we're going to be competitive, we got to have a highly educated workforce. Right now, we're losing population in Massachusetts. Our higher education sector is expensive. And as fees keep rising, it's more and more prohibitive. And, as a result of the pandemic and other factors, we have more people and we have declining demographics in that age level moving away from higher education. So we've got to do something to turn around the sort of 20-year, 30-year now public disinvestment in higher education and placing the burden on students. So she has done really two things. I mean, she's, number one, declared a price freeze. So tuition and fees, as I understand it from the proposal, I haven't read all the specific details. Tuition and fees at UMass, at the state universities and at community colleges will be frozen for 4 years. In other words, you can predict what you're going to have to pay rather than be subject to increases all along your time within school. You can predict what you're going to have to pay when you first enroll. The second thing is she's added various quantities of money to scholarship and subsidy for the system itself, drawing in part on some of the money that came from the millionaire's tax originally. So I think these are two big steps in the right direction. As many people have commented, we're still, even if you freeze us where we are right now, we're not in a good place in terms of the affordability of higher education for students. Public higher education is supposed to be, the last resort for somebody who wants to get educated but can't afford the outsized prices that prevail in the private sector. And we're a long way from making that readily accessible, and we've just got to do better. So she's put a clear indicator out there that this is a priority. She's going to move in that direction, and she's taken a couple of good steps.
And by the way, I'm glad you mentioned what you mentioned. And for those business leaders making more than $1 million a year who are subject to the surtax, the millionaire's tax, knowing that a significant chunk of this went to making our workforce and our education system more competitive with the rest of the country, which from what I understand is the centerpiece of demands or desires of business leaders, they should feel a little bit better about that additional few bucks that they are giving to the state every April 15th. We're talking to Paul Revel.
So Paul Revel, apparently in anticipation of St. Patrick's Day, some of the kids up at UMass engaged in the annual tradition called the Blarney Blowout. And this, for a while, they've indulged this drinking fad involving something called the Borg. So hear a little sound from a TikTok from a college kid explaining how you make the Borg.
So first you need a gallon of water. You want to pour out about half of it. Now it's time to add your liquor. Today we're using Tito's vodka. I put in probably like a third of this. And the final real step in making a Borg is to add your Mio or some Cristalite. But I like to add some special juice, so I'm going to throw in a Celsius. This is the sparkling wild berry flavor. And then lastly, because it's only 1 p.m., we're going to add some liquid IV so we don't get hungover at midnight. It's really good. Everyone reviewed it and also said it tastes really good. So happy snow day.
By the way, that kid's parents just called in and said how proud they are. So I just wanted
that's
to
right.
Do
well,
a
apparently
shout out.
The Borg drinking and other drinking resulted in 46 patients between 18 and 25 showing up at the local Cooley Dickinson Hospital in 32 different ambulances. So I don't know what to make of this. I mean, kids do overindulge on St. Patrick's Day, and we can go to the St. Patrick's Day parade in South Boston and see that kind of thing. But there is seems to be kind of a bingy kind of drinking problem that persists in college instead of like, let's just go to a mixer and have a couple of beers thing. And we don't seem to be able to fix it.
Well, I mean, it's pervasive. I mean, the power of TikTok to bring forward a new approach to doing this, and one that, you know, defies law enforcement in certain ways. And, you know, and lest I be accused of hypocrisy, I, you know, from time to time was my own out of control drinker when I was in college. So I can't be holier than thou on this. But it seems to me, you know, this is, by the way, 2 weeks in advance of St. Patrick's
Day. That's right. They're starting early.
They're in training.
Lord knows what's going to happen on the actual day itself. I sympathize with administrators, one of whom said she hadn't even heard of a Borg before, which puts her in the same category as me. But I'm
yeah. Well, you're right. If you have it in a water jug, then you are not going to bring attention to cops who may pull you over looking for beers. You've got a water jug and the vodka, you may or may not be able to smell it. I don't know.
Paul, have you ever heard of the Amethyst Initiative?
I love that.
This is this. We've talked about this a lot through the years. This is a thing started more than 10 years ago, I think, by the president of Middlebury College, where scores.
Amherst?
No, I think it was Middlebury. I'm not sure. But scores and scores of college presidents and administrators signed on to this thing where they thought the United States should take a relook at the drinking age in this country. And they thought that one of the reasons why there is this kind of binge drinking, et cetera, is because of the taboo nature of it. And I'm not sure they specifically embraced an 18-year-old drinking age, but they surely embraced a dialogue as to whether or not 21, sort of graduation time, is too late to sort of stem
because
this in the bud.
Because the 18-year-olds would be doing jello shots in their closet before they went out because they weren't allowed to drink in a normal fashion at a social event. They had to be 21. Yep. And so that it was teaching bad habits around liquor as opposed to, you know, good social drinking habits around liquor.
Yeah, well, I mean, on the one hand, I'm sympathetic to that. I mean, I remember when we were kids, I grew up in Western Mass, and just across the border, you know, you could get alcohol at age 18 in New York, but you had to wait till 21. And particularly, that was the time of Vietnam War. We were saying, you know, you're sending people off to war to get killed.
Yes.
And you can't buy a drink until they're 21. So there are some real inconsistencies in that. You know, at the same time, I know that college administrators have, you know, historically torn their hair out about this because they know students will drink. It is illegal in their jurisdiction. And yet their capacity to enforce the state's laws on drinking are really limited, as we can see in UMass, you know, regularly and on most campuses where we have these kinds of episodes. And so, I mean, philosophically, theoretically, that, you know, that argument makes some sense to me. Culturally, you know, that we've made it taboo, even though, you know, I mean, at high school level, we know kids are drinking. And I think, you know, people who are concerned about road safety are worried that if you move the age down, then you make it possible, you know, for 15-year-old, 14-year-olds to get it. And you know, they'll be out on the roads and things of that nature. So I'm not sure what the right answer. I mean, this is a really thorny issue, but I sympathize with the college administrators who are trying to do something about it. And they tried to get prepared, and it just got out of control at UMass.
Well, we're glad you got things under control, Paul Revel, after you got out of college.
Life, yes.
You slowed down your pace.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of heavy drinking that goes on in the college years, right? And sometimes even into the early 20s. But anyway, thank you very much
good
for being with
you,
us
Paul.
Today, Paul Revel. Appreciate it.
All right. Good to be with you. Thank you.
Yep, you too. We've been speaking with Paul Revel, former Secretary of Education, professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he leads the Ed Redesign Lab. His latest book, co-authored with Lynn Sachs, A Collaborative Action for Equity and Opportunity, Practical Guide for School and Community Leaders. Okay, coming up, we have got a real treat for a Thursday. You're going to hear some great music up next right here in the Brighton studio. We'll be joined by Nina Freelon and Chelsea Green. They're here for the Boston Celebrity Series Jazz Festival. We're going to hear about that, and we're going to hear their sound. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We'll be at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. In 2022, the Celebrity Series of Boston took a chance on a new venue in South Boston, this spectacular Artists for Humanity Epicenter. The string of shows ended up, no surprise, being a big hit in the center's modern, intimate atmosphere, drinks available. So they're trying their luck for a second time. Right now, they're calling it the Celebrity Series Jazz Festival. It started yesterday. It'll run through March 11th. Tomorrow night at 7, multi-Grammy-nominated singer Nina Freelon will perform alongside violinist Chelsea Green and Brandon McCune. For more information, we'll give you this website again, celebrityseries.org. And by the way, Nina's latest album, which I listened to last night, which is just otherworldly, Time Traveler. She's also got a podcast we'll discuss in a minute. Chelsea, for her part, released an EP in 2020, listen to that too, with the Chelsea Green and the Green Project called Re-Envision. Nina and Chelsea join us now in Studio 3 and are going to perform for us in a couple of minutes. It's a thrill to meet you both. Thanks so much
for being
here.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good to be here.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, for coming in. Your work is incredible. Let's start with you, Nina. You dreaded local angle. You're a Cambridge kid.
I am. Now,
you're back in town. So what was your deal in Cambridge?
Fresh pond, anyone?
Fresh pond, everyone, I think, is the
answer.
That's
right. That's right. I grew up in West Cambridge and ran those streets. We had a fabulous, maybe everybody thinks their childhood was wonderful. Mine really was.
And you sang in a couple of churches in Central Square and stuff?
Absolutely got my start in church. Absolutely.
So, and Chelsea, you've got the dreaded local angle, too. You teach at Berkeley, right, from time to time. And you performed solo with the Pops at one point?
I did. I had the very fortunate honor of performing with Rhiannon Giddens for Pops concerts. Yeah, it was fantastic.
So how is it to be back in town for you after spending your ute, as they say,
my ute,
in this part of the world there, Nina?
It's way different. Like, this studio wasn't here the last time I was here.
Yeah.
And everything around this area just doesn't look familiar. Where the venue is, totally, totally different.
Somebody's South,
like,
Boston.
You have a gig in Southie? Yes, I do. And you need to come to see to believe it.
Well, how many times have you played in a venue like this, a studio about 3 feet by 3 feet? I mean, this is pretty tight.
This is primo, though. This is primo. Primo intimate.
Yes, intimate.
You know, Nina, before I play and talk more about your music, I learned preparing to talk with you that you have a podcast, Great Grief. You lost your husband to ALS, which was very difficult. Obviously, tell us about your husband and then tell us about the podcast you've created. I just love it.
Oh, thank you so much. Great Grief is an opportunity for us to step away from our grief avoidant culture and just talk about it. It happens to everybody. Why don't we talk about it? And because I'm a singer, of course, I sing on the podcast. My husband, Phil Freelon, was a wonderful husband, a great father. We were married for 40 years. He is also the architect of record on the African American Museum of History and Culture. And he went to MIT, so there's another sort of local connection. And ALS is horrible. It is like the worst. So this podcast is a way for me to process my grief. It's a way for me to open it up for other people who've lost someone that they loved, to talk about it and to just have I wouldn't say a safe space. What is that anyway? But a brave space.
You know, we have a little piece from, on this Great Grief, Marjorie and I are both listening this morning. We hear Nina in conversation about grief. In this clip, we hear from grief herself. Here it is.
Yeah, I'm in the room, making noise, rearranging the furniture, doing what I do. Almost always, folk get squirmy, feel a little awkward. I guess I'm used to it. Not receiving invitations to hang out and just kick it. Usually folk just suffer my presence, avoid my gaze, looking askance.
Again, check it out. It's called Great Grief. So before these two wonderful souls perform, explain what the mission of this Chelsea Green and the Green Project is there, Chelsea Green.
Well, you know, I appreciate that question because there is not one singular mission. I think for
me, what are the missions?
Right,
exactly.
Right. I am very passionate that all of us existing in life are improvisers. We all have to improvise every single day. I always say a single mother is one of the most, you know, award-winning masters of improvisation. And so with the Green Project.
I had one of those, by the way, so I know that to be true.
So I hope that through the project, through what I articulate through the violin, as I try to make it a musical instrument, not just a classical one, that it can speak to many different life patterns and how we can articulate our own voice uniquely through whatever we do in life.
Okay, so you're going to do a couple of numbers for us. What's the first one you're going to do? What are you doing there,
Nina? We're going to take an old Eden Abbez tune. Mm-hmm. You may know it as Nature Boy. Uh-huh. Probably Nat King Cole was the first time we heard it, but Chelsea and I are going to do our own thing with it, with this lovely standard. Said to me, the greatest thing. That you will ever, ever learn is just to love and be loved in return.
Oh my God.
Let me tell you, I hate to make everybody jealous. The only thing better than listening to that was watching the two of you. How much have you two done together, Nina?
We are actually soulmates.
You really are.
We are soulmates. We don't want to talk about time because then you'll be like, oh, anybody can do this. But we are connected soul to soul, and that's what makes this possible. When Chelsea talked about improvisation, 99.9% of that is listening, but with a heart of a listener. You know, not just being quiet while somebody else talks, but really listening for what is said and what is not said.
But you were like one, by the way. I know. I mean, you really were like watching you from 5 feet away. Do you know what I'm saying, Chelsea? It was like one person.
I appreciate that.
Yeah,
I
that's mean, an awesome compliment.
That is a very high compliment for sure.
Well,
we have been treated to
not
incredible.
Not King Cole's calling in right
yeah,
now.
That's
let me
right.
tell
you. Yeah. But go ahead. We've been treated, Chelsea, to incredible violin performances in recent days. Last week we had people in that were going to be in the St. Patrick's Day Sojourn, you know, playing music from Ireland, of course, and Great Britain. And then earlier this week we had Mark O'Connor, his wife Maggie. I guess
Fantastic.
They're more Americana.
Yeah,
they came in and they played in the studio. And now you are playing a whole – I mean, it's the versatility. I guess what I'm trying to say is violin is a rather versatile instrument.
That's the goal. Yes,
yeah.
Indeed.
And it's hard. I don't think people realize how hard it is to play, right? And get those notes exactly right.
It can be a tricky one.
Yeah.
It's kind of similar to the voice.
It is.
You know, because there's a relative sensibility of what you feel in your body and what you hear, and you make these minute adjustments or not. There's also not. And when you're playing with another, this is what I'm so excited about for this concert.
Yeah,
it's conversational, right? Yes. It's like we're having an intimate conversation, an intimate musical conversation. Mm-hmm. So I'm psyched about that.
And by the way, if people have not been to this venue, I've been to a number of things there. It is spectacular. It is just it's just beautiful and it's intimate and it's just great. You know, we talked about your late husband who was obviously very accomplished. You've got a kid who's pretty accomplished, and you and your kid made history last year. Did they not? Did
we
you not,
did.
Nina? At the
we
Grammys?
Did.
What was the deal?
At the Grammys. First of all, I have three children. Family politics. he's the youngest, Pierce. Pierce and I made history by being the first mother and son to be nominated in separate categories in the same Grammy year.
Yeah.
And wasn't he trying to reach you on the phone? I realized.
Oh, my gosh.
You didn't even know you'd been nominated.
Well, so they announced the Grammys, the winners of the nominees on like a. It was on, what was it on? TV?
Yeah,
or it was like
and it's
Instagram.
Super early in the morning. Yeah, on Instagram.
It was early
yes.
in the, and so mm-hmm. he was. He said, Ma, you want me to come over so we can watch together? I was like, no, I don't. I'm going to walk the dog. So his category, children's music, came up first. And, of course, he was excited. Yeah. And while I was out walking the dog, my category was read, and he heard my name. So when I came in the house and he's like, Mom. I was like, what's wrong with you? What happened? He was crying. He was like, Mom, you were... nominated too.
That's awesome.
By the way, we're going to say it another couple of times. CelebritySeries.org to get tickets for any of the nights of this four-night thing, including these two wonderful players and performers tomorrow. Before you perform one more here, Chelsea, I think what Nina was saying to me, because she didn't want to say it directly, is this the first time you've performed together?
I mean,
sort of officially, not officially. Okay. I mean, because honestly, we were together previously on the West Coast.
Palm Desert.
In Palm Desert, we did an engagement that oddly felt about as cold as it does here today in Palm Desert. But, you know, it isn't so musically, this is not our first connection.
So before you play whatever you're going to play and perform, whatever you perform, what's it like performing with Nina Chelsea?
It is a extraordinary, otherworldly experience only because of how connected she is to her art. Uh-huh. And I say that it's such a powerful and dynamic iteration of what I imagine as, you know, a musician to be that one with your voice and your art,
okay,
and the lyric.
Now your turn, Nina. What's it like singing with Chelsea?
See, you know, somehow certain people like put you on the spot, like the spot. Chelsea is an amazing musician, but more than that, we're playing each other's hearts.
Oh boy,
that's what's happening. If you feel something, it's because we are connected in a heart to heart way. She's my sister. And we come from different backgrounds, we have different musical experiences, but when we come into this setting, heart to heart.
Do you know you sing when you talk? Do you know that? I'm sure you've been told
We want to get a little bit more of what we felt, your first song again, with the second song, Heart to Heart. So what are you going to play for us?
There's an old, you know, all the songs I sing are old, except for the ones that I wrote, and maybe they're old too by definition, but Hoagy Carmichael. Wrote a song called Skylark. We're going to do that one.
Okay.
Nina Freelon and Chelsea Green.
Is there a meadow in the mist where someone's waiting to be kissed? Skylark, have you seen a valley green with spring where my heart can go a journeying over the shadows and the rain to her blossom-covered lane? And in your lonely flight, haven't you heard the music in the night? Wonderful music, faint as a will-o'-the-wisp, crazy as a loon, sad as a gypsy serenading the moon. Oh, Skylark, I don't know if you can find these things, but my heart is riding on your wings. If you see them anywhere, won't you lead me? If you see them anywhere, Skylark, lead me there.
Oh, my goodness. What a thrill.
That we've been speaking and listening to and hearing the amazing music of Nina Freelon and Chelsea Green. Their show is going to be this Friday night, 7 o'clock, at the Arts for Humanity Epicenter in South Boston as part of the Celebrity Series Jazz Festival. This is just a hint of how wonderful the whole event is going to be. For more information and to get tickets, go to celebrityseries.org. That's celebrityseries.org.
You were spectacular.
Nina and Chelsea, thank you so much for coming.
Thank
and that
you.
Was a that was
so
an amazing
much.
Treat. Okay, yikes. From the sublime to the less, much less sublime, after a quick break, Marie Kondo, you may remember her. She was the global leader in living for a clutter-free life of serenity. Well, guess what? Now that she's had a couple of kids, she's doing a flip-flop. She's embracing the mess. The woman that told us to declutter ruthlessly doesn't think we need to do that anymore. And we're going to open the lines and ask you if you can embrace the mess and if you feel conned by the queen of clean. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. That is our number to call us or text us. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live at the library tomorrow. Let me just repeat, they both were
unbelievable.
Just
unbelievable.
And by the way, it's an intimate venue down there. You get to be close to the players, the performers, and they were both just terrific.
And a lot of kids' artwork on the walls down there.
It's a great place. And in an interview she gave with the Washington Post in January, I didn't even know about this till today, the queen of decluttering herself, Marie Kondo, admitted she's gotten more lax about tidiness since having her third child. In her new book, she wrote, quote, "Tidying up means dealing with all the things in your life. What do you really want to put in order?" Now she's got TikTok influencers on our side, though you could make the case that teenagers have always been pro-mess. Still in a piece out in the New York Times, I think it was this morning, or maybe yesterday, "This trend is a mess. Influencers on TikTok are being unabashed about the clutter in their own lives. Gone are the days of, you know, tossing your dirty clothes under the bed, shoving everything in a closet before company arrives. We want to hear about what messiness means to you. If it's brought you solace, given you space, like Marie Kondo, to focus on things that matter more, is messiness the hot new it lifestyle trend that some are heralding, or are all of us just embracing the mess we've been living with all along? Our number is 877-301-8970. I have to say proudly, if you've ever seen Studio 3, you know that Marjorie and I have really embraced the mess in our work. Again, 877-301-8970. Not everybody is happy with Marie Kondo. Do you see the thing online that a lot of women
conned.
Are saying they feel K-O-N-N-E-D,
conned
by
Who can
Ms.
Blame
Kondo.
Them? Yeah.
But you're, you know, I say organized mess, if that doesn't sound oxymoronic. I like things like, I don't put things away so everything is tidy and everything is clean, but I like things sort of organized in their messiness. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
No, you're like a pack rat.
Well, I am
you're a hoarder.
I am a hoarder.
You're the person that could have been on her show. Remember her show? She was trying to take care of this couple early on in the show, and they walked into their house, and they had books and papers and magazines
up to the
ceiling. Up to the ceiling in their house, and you went into the basement, and they had like it looked like the Santa's workshop. They had like 9 million Christmas decorations and stuff like that. They were hoarders. I was very influenced by Marie Kondo because I am a messy person, and I hate being a messy person. And I learned a lot from her about how to be unmessy. But I think
I've thrown out like scores and scores of boxes of things.
Don't you spend entire vacations throwing out?
I do. It's thrilling. But you know what I'm gonna do now? Bring them all back in. I mean. Now that I've seen that she's done a 180, 877-301-8970. Have you embraced the mess, I guess, is our topic for the rest of today's show. I'm still shaken, by the way, from those two women.
Oh, my God.
They were just,
I mean, that was phenomenal.
That
was phenomenal. We're so
God.
Lucky that we got a chance to hear them. They're phenomenal.
In any case.
But anyway, get back to Marie Kondo. I mean, where are you in this whole mess situation? I think if you got little kids, you could just forget it. I mean, things are going to be a mess. The toys are everywhere. You have the toy box that doesn't work. The kids are throwing everything all over the place. Or if you have teenagers, my attitude was just shut the door and hope that, you know, that too many rodents don't get in there because the teenagers are like total slobs. But But I do like the idea of a decluttered place. That I aspire to be a decluttered person, and I have not achieved that. In fact, when I was in my 20s, I lived in a two-family. The apartment downstairs got robbed, and the cops came upstairs. They knocked on our door. They opened the door and said, oh, looks like you got ransacked, too. And I said, well, no, actually.
Do you remember we had a
you
Pulitzer?
Were not ransacked.
Before we go to the calls and the text, we had a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and it's horrible. I forget her name for a second. I'll think of it in a minute. Who offered to clean up your mess in the studio for you.
Yes.
I'll think of her name.
And, I can't think of her last name.
We'll figure out who she is in a minute. That's how bad it is that our guests, Pulitzer Prize winning guests, decide they're going to help Marjorie declutter her life.
Yeah, mostly Jim stuff. It's Jim stuff in
there. That's actually not true. Colin, you're in South Boston. You're first on Boston Public Radio on the de-messing hour. Hello there.
Hello. So great chat with you folks. I feel like I've been bothering you a lot lately, but clutter and oh boy, do we have an interesting relationship. So I just went from living with my mom, 23 years old. I just got cut loose. The umbilical cord got cut.
Yeah.
And I had to go from.
Colin, we lost you for a second. Colin, after umbilical cord, we lost you. So take it from there. We're going to put Colin on hold because I really want to talk to Colin. We have a horrible connection. We'll hope he can get in a better spot, and we'll return to him since he has just cut the umbilical cord, I think, days ago and is now out on his own, and we'll see how he's dealing with that. 877-301-8097. By the way, Marie Kondo's original advice, till she did a 180, is what is it? One, does it spark joy? You hold up the
item.
That was really helpful. And two, if you haven't used something, is it in 6 months?
I think it's a year.
Whatever it is, toss the damn thing. It's
really
helpful.
Well, you don't just toss it, Jim. There's a process.
What is it?
You hold the item in your arm, say it in your hand, say
it's
a sweater.
You thank it.
And you thank it for its service, and you say how much you loved it and how it had sparked joy in you previously.
But
it no longer sparks joy in you. So you either decide to give it to Goodwill.
Boomerangs.
Or boomerangs, that's right. Or you throw it out, but you can't throw out textiles. That's
environmentally
incorrect.
That's a new problem.
Incorrect, right?
Let's try Colin one more time in South Boston.
Okay.
We're post-cutting of umbilical cord, Colin. Take it from there.
Okay, so I had to go from a bedroom full of my stuff to a broom closet apartment with two roommates, and it was probably the hardest thing ever to get rid of these things, even though, you know, clutter is cluttering the mind, cluttering the life, and I just found it so hard to throw out these participation medals. And I think, you know, seeing that 180 makes me almost think, wow.
So how'd it go? I know it was hard. How'd it go?
So I'll give you one anecdotal moment of the decluttering.
Please.
So last night, it was December 16th, a dark, cold evening.
Mm-hmm.
My brother rented a U-Haul truck, put the last of my junk in it, and said, all right, throw out what you want, take the rest of your apartment, this is it. And we were in the Square One Mall parking lot in Saugus, throwing out all manner of things, of knickknacks, books, etc., into this dumpster. And then I took the rest of my apartment, and that was all. And it was, wow, so freeing, yet I felt like so much of my childhood was torn away. But really, what does it matter if I remember the things?
Let me tell you, there are very few calls where I laugh and I cry in the same call. And Colin, I did in yours. Thank you very much for your contribution.
Jim, I've got the author that we couldn't remember the name. I'm ashamed on us because she's a great author. Yeah. Ann Patchett.
No, it wasn't Ann Patchett.
She
was here, but it wasn't her.
She wrote Bel Canto, Commonwealth, State of Wonder. Yeah, it was Ann Patchett.
I know we had her, but she wasn't the one that cleaned. Was she the one that offered to clean up your stuff?
Yes.
Okay, Ann Patchett.
You know why another one of her books was called?
No.
Truth and Beauty. And she came into our studio, and she was absolutely horrified.
Well, her most famous book, for which she won the Pulitzer, I believe, was Messy Room, Messy Mind. Was it not? I believe that was her.
You know what Marie Kondo also did? She had a certain way of folding things up. You're supposed to fold, if you're underpants, if you're a woman, into these little, like a little package. And
I thought you roll them. Don't you roll them?
Well, you kind of roll them, but and so they would all stand up the right way in your drawer, and you're supposed to roll up the T-shirts. Organizing your drawers was a big theme of hers, too. And it worked. It really. And the other thing that was great about her, if you open your closet, you can't find anything in your closet.
Yeah.
I had this problem for years and years and years. You're supposed to arrange them by height so that your long dresses are on the left, the shorter dresses.
When did you do that, by the way? I forgot.
I did it. I did do it.
Not.
Yes, I did. I have maintained a lot of her advice, and it's really helped me. I mean, I'm not looking forever for everything. Mm-hmm. And there's your closet just goes from the longest up mm-hmm. to the shortest. So at the other end of the right-hand side
wow.
are blouses or short T-shirts. It's a brilliant way to organize your
brilliant,
closet.
Brilliant. I'm proud of you, too. Joe in Boston, what's up?
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I have a little slightly different take on this.
Please.
I became a student of the feng shui.
Sure. There you go.
I always pronounce it wrong.
No, it's close enough.
And basically, when you keep the place in your place in order, it allows the positive energy or the positive chi to flow.
Mm-hmm, of course.
That's right.
So when I clean out a closet, which I, for some reason, have to do all the time,
mm-hmm.
Right after I finish cleaning it out, sometimes the next day, I'm a freelance artist. The yeah. next day, sometimes I get a phone call, I get a gig, because the positive chi is able to move through the room.
That's unbelievable.
Okay, Joe, explain feng shui to people.
It has happened a dozen times. To put a,
wow.
That is haunting, Joe. Feng shui is just sort of like arranging stuff in your life to create like the perfect balance kind of thing. Is that not it?
Isn't your bed supposed to be that your feet are toward the door, so in case you die in your sleep, they can carry you out feet first?
There are books and books and books written on the subject. And what the beauty of it is, you don't have to follow the whole thing. You take bits and pieces of it, and it works. The Russian Jewish feng shui advisor, who lives in Brookline, you know who you are, turned me on to this a few years ago. And basically, you don't have to prescribe to the religious aspects of things. But for me, it works. And I'll finish up with just a couple of weeks ago, I cleaned out a space full of junk. And I was almost expecting to hear from somebody. And nobody reached out to me. Until 5 days later, I realized someone had messaged me through my Instagram, which I never checked.
Sure enough,
I had a huge project to bid on. I didn't get the job, but it was a huge project, a 2-day gig to bid on the day after I did this clean out. So for me, it works.
That was fabulous. That was another fabulous call. Joe, thank you for that.
Well, maybe
I don't think you're doing feng shui.
Clean my closet.
Although
I did find a coat. I was looking for a coat, moving around a coat.
Really?
And I found my earbuds, whatever you call them.
The ones you dropped in the mulch?
Different, not the ones
I dropped
in the mulch,
okay.
No. Okay, Paul from Worcester says, as much as it pains me to agree with Jim, I also have a well-organized whole bunch of stuff, partly because I repurpose things like styrofoam into coolers when bringing food to others, or old clothes into shop rags. And a messy workshop is a dangerous workshop.
By the way, he brought food to us today. You're not in the studio, but let me tell you, it was unbelievable.
Did you eat it all?
Paul, thank you. I didn't eat yours.
Thank you.
They ate yours.
Will you bring it? Will you?
Joel and Ashland.
Mine's gone?
Sorry, you got to come to work if you want the food. Joel and Ashland.
You're going to bring it to me
tomorrow? Joel and Ashland, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about whatever. Hello, Joel. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
And to you.
Many time caller. I was talking about my wife when I moved into her apartment about 40 years ago. 40 years ago.
Yeah.
I came home from work and wanted to get out of my suit and get into my jeans, and I'm looking around for my jeans,
mm-hmm.
and I can't find them anywhere. So I said to her, "Do you see my jeans? You know, I want to change into them." She says, "Oh, you left them on the floor. I figured they were garbage, so I threw them out."
All right. Well, that's not unreasonable, is it?
She also took a cantaloupe and cleaned the seeds off on it. So, I definitely had a clean those pants up, but I'm still with her 40 years later.
You haven't been putting your pants on the floor since, have you, my friend?
Yeah, have you cleaned up your act? Are you a neat guy now?
I'm not going to answer. Oh, definitely not.
Oh, really?
I can hear it in his voice.
I
don't think so, Joel.
I'm better, but I wouldn't claim to be good.
Have a melon on us, Joel. Thank you very much for the call. That's a pretty good story there, too.
What was that TV show, The Odd Couple? One guy was a real neatnik, the other guy was a real slob. And they were
it's like a pretty famous Neil Simon play before it was a television show.
Judith and Gatuit.
Walter Matthau and Tony Randall. Were they not the originals, I think?
Judith and Gatuit. Thank you for calling.
And who? Jack Lemmon. Thank you, John. Of course, John Parker knows Jack Klugman and Tony Randall on TV. Courtesy of John Parker. Judith from Gatuit, you're next. Hi.
Hi. This is my first call to you. I've listened for so long, and
I'll tell you,
I really had to wait for something I feel strongly about.
Excellent.
Oh, good.
And My hatred for Marie Kondo is so deep and intense.
Oh, do tell. Why
is that, Judith?
So my best friend is an ace at organizing. And yeah. years ago, she brought this book to my attention. You have to read this. And I started reading it, and I said, this woman is mentally disturbed. She's a psychological bully.
Yeah.
If you read the first few chapters of her book, she talks about, as a child, organizing her siblings' and her parents' drawers.
That's right.
Like, oh, my God, how dare she? Like, and the withering way she'd go on TV and just shake her head at how one of the hosts would fold an undershirt. I mean, oh my goodness. I mean, her aesthetic is very sterile, fine, mm-hmm. but to impose that on the world, I'm just outraged that she's become so popular and she's become this cult leader, and now she's coming out and saying that she was wrong.
It's one of the great calls of the 21st century.
And she's got another book out of it.
Yeah, another
and she's
book out of
another
it.
Book out of it.
Out of it. And I know. So, Judith, are you feeling better now that she's done a 180, or you resent her even more?
Oh, no. My hatred just, like, dug another 6 feet deep.
Dug another 6 feet, yeah, okay.
Oh, Judith, you're
so, Judith, we really hope you feel passionately about something else really soon. And call us again. That was a perfect way to end the show.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you.
She did do a nice job in my closet.
She really hates her.
She does. Well, I can see.
She doesn't hate her. She really hates her.
Yeah, didn't she rearrange everybody's dolls and, you know, all this kind of stuff? I mean, literally, she's running around. She's barely out of diapers. She's running around arranging everything in the house. There was something going on there.
Let me tell you, if you're living in Katuit, watch out for Judith. So I don't want to cast aspersions, but watch out.
That's right.
Okay, we're done.
We are done. Thank you very much for listening today to Boston Public Radio. You can keep up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast. Tomorrow we are going to be live at the Boston Public Library with our with Boston Medical Center's Dr. Catherine Gergen-Barnett. She's going to take our questions and yours, not just on COVID, but on other medical questions you might have. I'm going to ask about medical tourism in Mexico that I didn't realize was as big of a deal as it apparently is, and even for like dental care. GBH's Callie Cross is going to be with us as well. NYU medical ethicist Art Kaplan, media maven Sue O'Connell, and a live Music Friday performance from Boston's LGBTQ plus aligned chorus, Coro Allegro. I want to thank our
crew.
You left
one thing out. You left
what?
Judith is going to come do a 20-minute thing about Marie Kondo live from the Boston Public Library.
I love her.
My
I mean,
God.
She's, you know, I think a lot of people have been,
she
could be on Judith's
for
side.
A lot of people, she was.
Okay. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aiden Conley, Nicole Garcia, Hannah Loss, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, back to tell us what the movie was in 1972 that starred Jack Lemmon or didn't star Jack Lemmon. And our executive producer is Jimmy Bologna. Thank you very much for tuning in. Jim, thank you very much. And please bring my food tomorrow to the Boston Public Library.
Unfortunately, it's a little late.
Oh, it's a little late? Okay.
We brought you some other stuff, so we'll take care
Okay, fine. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browning.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you can tune in tomorrow. I hope you had a fun time today. And have a great afternoon.
Bye.